Everybody ready?
Yes.
Okay. Going to open our House Interim Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. Today's Tuesday, September 21st. Going to first announce that we received the report on the shipping and transport of aquatic invasive species. It's being presented, I think, in a Senate committee, but we've got the paper report if anybody is interested in that. It's maybe 78 pages, a little light reading for folks, but I know we have some members really interested in that issue here. And we're going to open our informational meeting. We're going to start with the update on the Transferable Development Rights Pilot Program that was embodied in House Bill 2228 that this committee passed out last session, and ask Richard Whitman and Bob Rindy to come up and talk to us about how it's going. Hey, guys.
Good morning. Chair Clem, members of the committee, Richard Whitman, the Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I have with me today Bob Rindy from the department, who's a policy analyst who is helping working on implementation of this program. I'd like to start out by just refreshing everyone's memory about why we worked on this legislation in the last session and what the underlying problem is that we're trying to resolve here. Oregon, as you know, in its statewide land use planning program has something called Goal 4, which is to protect forest land for forest uses. And Oregon has been relatively quite successful in terms of protecting forest land for active timber management. Some recent work done by the Oregon Department of Forestry shows that in western Washington state, Western Washington has retained about 95% of timberland in that part of the state of Washington in what's called wildland forest. Oregon, by contrast, has retained about a little over 98% of its forest is wildland forest. And this is over the period, from 1975 to about 2005. I'm getting old and I'm starting to mix my decades. So that 3% increment between Western Washington and Oregon may not sound like much, but it translates into hundreds of thousands of acres of forest land that Oregon has been successful in retaining in wildland forests relative to the state of Washington, very similar sorts of landscapes. What wildland forest is it's forest where the density of dwellings averages less than four dwelling units per square mile. And that's important because that is a tipping point level. That's a point where once the level of residential development starts to go above that, forest landowners start to manage that land very differently. The highest and best use starts to become residential use rather than commercial forest, and you start to see the land split up and sold off for basically very large tract residential home sites rather than commercial forest use. That means what happens on the ground changes. It stops being managed for timber, starts being sort of passively managed. It also has direct consequences for the state in terms of the cost of protecting that land in terms of wildfire. Once you start to have more structures on the land, your strategy for protecting that land in a wildfire starts to change, and you start to be much more active in terms of cost. So it's important in policy terms to try to keep that level of residential development out on the landscape below that level. And Oregon has been quite successful in doing that. Again, we're at 98% of the forest land base that existed in 1975 has stayed in wildland forest in the state of Oregon, and we believe that's largely as a result of the state's land use program. All that said, we still have a very disturbing trend occurring in Oregon. Oregon's not immune to what's happening nationally in terms of the economy and the ownership of forest lands transitioning from sort of long-term ownership for commercial forest purposes to real estate investment trust and other forms of ownership that really are looking for that highest and best use return on forest land and looking for opportunities where it makes economic sense to sell off holdings for residential development. So that is starting to occur in Oregon. It hasn't occurred to the extent it has in other Western states, but nevertheless it is occurring. And that's what this transfer development right program is about. It's about that underlying economic pressure on the part of landowners to use their property for its highest and best use and to sell it off for residential use. So even though we see that we've been pretty successful in maintaining land as wildland forest, we are starting to see the numbers of dwellings creep up. They're still below that tipping point level of 4 units per square mile, but they're starting to creep up from 1 unit per square mile to 2 or 3 or close to 4 in certain parts of the state. We don't believe it's realistic to think about additional regulation of forest land as a response to that. The traditional regulatory tools that we've had in Oregon have their place. They set a baseline, but we're not expecting that we're going to do a lot more in terms of regulation of residential use of forest land. And we don't believe that there would be strong support for that. So where transfer development rights comes into this picture is it's a way of acquiring those development rights off of the forest lands that are most at risk of conversion from wildland forest, from active timber management, and moving those development rights to places on our landscape where they make more sense, where that additional development makes more sense. And that's what this program is about. And I'll just say it's emblematic of the sort of approach we would like to take in the land use program generally in terms of dealing with our rural lands, to use non-regulatory market-based tools to try to really go the next step in terms of working with landowners to create a win-win situation where we're not about stopping development, but we're about putting it in places that make sense for Oregon. So the program that you authorized in the last session authorized 3 pilot projects to occur in the state.
I'd like to welcome Mr. Chandler to the hearing. I've missed you something awful. Thank you.
So the program that you authorized in the last legislative session in House Bill 2228 is one part of House Bill 2228, authorized 3 pilot programs to move development rights off of up to 10,000 acres for each pilot program of forest land and put those development rights in places where they make more sense. And 3 so-called receiving areas were authorized under that legislation. One was property within an urban growth boundary. The second is so-called exception land or rural residential lands next to urban growth boundaries. And the third is in what are called rural unincorporated communities. Those are places like Welch's and Blue River in Lane County and a number of communities on the coast. Those are places where we think that additional development could occur and would make more sense. So for the past year, we have been working with counties and with forest landowners to try to get some pilots going. What we found is that, A, as you all know, the development market out there is terrible, and very little is being built right now. So there's a fair amount of interest on the part of forest landowners in this program long-term. But in terms of development opportunities and receiving areas to build new things, we are just not seeing a lot happen right now. We're also finding that frankly, and to some extent, we expected this to be the case. In order for this to work, there has to be an incentive for the property owner to make it worth their while. And putting additional development within our urban areas, although it's something that we would all like to see, it's something that communities are already trying to do. And so in terms of a market incentive for landowners, it doesn't really work very well. Where there is an incentive for property owners is to put that development in places where it would currently otherwise be restricted. And those are, right now under the current legislation, the rural residential areas next to urban growth boundaries and some of the unincorporated communities. So we are working on some legislation. It'll be up to whomever the next governor is to decide whether it is actually introduced. But at the agency level, we're working on legislation. We've been working with a small group of local governments and also some of the interest in our land use program on some tweaks to the transfer of development rights program to improve the incentives for the forest landowners and to deal with some of the obstacles to implementation of those projects that have been identified by local government. And I'll just talk briefly about each of those things. So first of all, in terms of improved incentives, we are looking at allowing that additional development, those units that are coming off of forest land and onto to new areas, to go into some additional areas. So we're talking about some types of rural communities that were not allowed under the past legislation. We're also looking at, there were some provisions in the legislation that required that the new development that occurred occur at a pretty high level of density. And we've heard back both from the development community and from local government that that really, A, isn't really realistic, and B, create some problems in some of the communities that we're looking at for where this additional development could occur in terms of services for that new development. So improve the incentives. We're also looking at more clearly authorizing the new development that could occur in the receiving areas to be, in some cases, non-residential development, so commercial or industrial development that could occur, and that would be done on the basis of value. So if you're moving development rights that are worth a certain amount off that forest land, you would get an increment in terms of new development that you could do in terms of non-residential for industrial or commercial in some of these other areas that we're looking at. So that's basically it. At this point, we are not talking about increasing the number of pilots, but we are talking about some tweaks to get this to work. We're continuing to work with not only the forest landowners, but local governments to make sure that we've got a program that will work on the ground. And finally, just in terms of setting expectations, the development market just continues to be so tough out there. You'll probably hear from Brother Chandler later today about just how bad it really is. It's so bad out there, it's going to take us a while to get these pilot programs done, because putting the deals together and finding the right opportunities where there is a market, it's going to be a while to work through this. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Did we put a sunset on that portion of the bill?
Not technically. What you asked is that we report back to the legislature in 2013 with what we've learned from hopefully three pilots.
So, you know, Representative Roblin chaired a pretty exhaustive interim work group that I think ended up resulting in another bill that's law as well, and that had to do with authorizing local governments to do banks and things like that in the end. And are any of that moving forward?
Chair Klim, there have been some discussions with local governments, some particular local governments, about doing some transfer of development right projects that don't fit the pilot program. And we are in some discussions with a couple of local governments about doing that, either under that legislation. I have to apologize. I can't remember that bill number. 760, Senate Bill 763. There are also... There have been a couple of other authorizations for this tool of transfer of development rights. One of them, I hesitate to say, was actually in Measure 49. And so we are talking with one local government about a potential transfer of development rights program involving Measure 49 to basically take Measure 49 authorizations that have been granted by the state and not take them away, but allow voluntarily the property owners, if they elect to carry out that development in another location that the local government would like to see that development occur in. So we're working on that idea also.
Any questions? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. You had mentioned services, and I guess one of the serious issues that I have, having been in a city that picked up a community that had no services, is this that it, obviously it's going to be a very important piece for the rural and unincorporated areas. So is that a significant piece in your discussions?
Chair Clem, Representative Van Norman, it is, and we are, in terms of the areas where this new development would occur, we're still working on the details of this, but we are looking at putting it in communities where the infrastructure either exists currently to serve that development or it can be provided in the relatively near future. So we're looking at communities that have some sort of community sewer or community water system, or where that community sewer system can be provided. In some cases, the new development could be a catalyst for a community that isn't currently sewered to basically make it financially feasible to provide sewer to that community. So we're also looking at where there's a health, particularly where there's a health problem with failing septic systems, at using this as a tool in that sense as well.
I am relieved to hear that. Thank you.
Representative Gilliam, your question. Go ahead.
Yes.
What day is it?
anybody else?
Maybe.
Do you know where you are?
Yeah. Vice Chair Krieger.
The value of timber itself in the last 2-3 years has gotten to the point where, especially if you're talking about non-industrial, you have your state tax, your federal tax, your severance tax, your forestry tax, your property tax.
Yep.
Then you got reforestation, then you got your maintenance. You keep breaking that down as a business model. Nobody in their right mind would cut a tree on private land, because when you get all done, you aren't going to have nothing in the bank. It's all going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to cause more pressure on people to want to change that designation and do something with it, because people get into their over years and they don't have many options or many years to do it?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, so obviously the tough economy has affected not only the development community but also the forest products industry, as you say, in terms of timber prices. And so while the development pressure in some ways has lessened on forest land because of so little building going on the other side, in terms of an alternative use, the economic return for timber has also gone down substantially. So I think these things will come back to some extent eventually, and then there'll be more pressure on the land for development, and at the same time the value for timber will start to come back at some point. So this is going to be a long-term effort. The economy will go through its cycles. Part of this is recognizing that and trying to create some stability out there on the landscape, because the timber products industry, as you know, involves making a very long-term investment in a very capital-intensive industry, and then hoping that at the end of that period that the market's going to be such that you'll get a return on it. So we're trying to create, again, that stability in the system to encourage continued commercial timber production in the state.
Anything for anybody else? Okay. All right.
Thank you,
gentlemen. So the next, I don't have to gavel in between these.
Yep.
So the next section,
we're back on schedule, facilitating development within the urban growth boundary. And this was something that Brother Chandler has talked about a number of times, that while we squabble over rural lands, we should be spending time making it easier to build in the areas that is part of the state's land use planning program, because that's where it's supposed to go, and it shouldn't be so difficult. So we're going to spend some time today, and I think during the next session, working on trying to make that happen. So we're going to start with Michael Jordan, who I think I saw Randy escort him in there. If you guys want to come up, Randy, I don't know if you're joining us or just Michael, but Yeah.
It's benefiting him to take our woods.
We welcome the new executive director of the Oregon Association of Nurseries and filthy Oregon duck, Jeff Stone, to the room as well.
Whoa.
Congratulations.
I'm going to hear about that later.
So I think we'll just do that. We'll just have the other gentleman come up afterwards. So, Michael, welcome.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here, I think. But thank you for having us all today. As you well know, first of all, I might ask, how many minutes or how long would you like us each to take?
A while for this one. You're not on a strict leash here, so maybe 10
minutes.
Oh,
my goodness, that's scary. Yeah. I can suck all the air.
As long as you identify yourself.
The longer I stay, the less time John has, right?
Yeah, that's
right.
You coming on already?
In the last couple of years, particularly, the...
Michael, could you just state your name for the record?
My name for the record. My name is Mike Jordan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Metro. Again, thank you for having us today. For the last couple of years, particularly, policymakers in the metropolitan region have been going through a number of major policy efforts, updating the regional transportation plan, doing the state-mandated urban growth report, a capacity analysis on the 20-year land supply, and then the one you've probably heard the most about recently, going through a process of creating urban and rural reserves.
No, I've never heard of it.
Never heard of it. Okay. It was a more collaborative process than we've ever been through in the past, particularly on reserves, when the county commissions of the three metropolitan counties and the Metro Council had to agree on the formation of those reserves through intergovernmental agreement. We were able to do that this last year in June. That decision is now pending acknowledgement before LCDC. That will occur in October, we're hoping. But through that process, I think more importantly than even the policy outcomes that came was the realization that to a very great degree, what was going to be the tale of our success in reaching the 2040 vision, the vision for growth in the metropolitan region, was going to depend on how we invested public capital and how that public capital related to private capital within the metropolitan region, and then along with that, our policies, which can in some cases inhibit development within the urban growth boundary, and how those interact with our desire to create the 2040 growth vision. And so we've embarked on a new effort really to try and take what is the best planned place on the planet and try and make it the best place on the planet. And we think we've dubbed that a process, a community investment strategy, and we are attempting to develop what we're calling an implementation strategy. The working title is the Community Investment Strategy. I think you have before you a sheet that looks like this inside the packet you've received. And it's really just a schematic to help us explain what we're trying to accomplish. You'll see at the top of that page the 2040 growth concept. It is the vision for growth, pretty well accepted, been about around 15 years. We still argue about it every 5 years in that cycle of capacity, but fairly well accepted vision for growth within the urban growth boundary. In the last couple of years, in the red box, policymakers have adopted not only Metro Council policymakers, but the folks who represent local governments have agreed on adopting six outcomes. They are stated in longer terms inside that executive summary that you have. But the shorthand really are things that won't come as any surprise to anybody. On page six of that overview document, you'll find those outcomes listed. All they really do is articulate in a little more detailed terms what we're trying to accomplish with the 2040 growth concept. What I'd like to focus on today a little bit is that green box and what's below it. Again, we believe where we've fallen short in the region is in implementation. We've only seen what I would characterize as spotty success in the realization of the 2040 growth concept within the region. And we believe that our future success will lie very much in how we invest the public's money in the next 25 to 50 years. we know below that green box that investments really come from two major sources, the public and private sector, and in the game, if you will, the private sector is the majority partner. In any urban landscape in the United States, about $3 out of $4 that are invested in the built environment are private dollars, and only about $1 of $4 are public dollars. And those public dollars come from multiple sources, as you can see on the left of that diagram. We're fairly familiar with those sources, but it might be worth acknowledging in the bottom two boxes that the toolkit at the regional level is anemic at best, and that most of the investment capability lies at the local government level. And then you can see that those investments on the right hand of that sheet occur across multiple realms, if you will, land use, transportation, economic development, etc. And we have in the region fairly well-developed and mature plans with projects and prioritization in a few of those realms. Land use, we're very familiar with. The system is very mature, and there's relative consensus around it. Again, we argue about some of the parts of it every now and then, but we're very used to it. Been doing it about 30 years now. Secondly, transportation, as I mentioned, we just adopted an updated regional transportation plan. Again, we argue about which projects and how much money goes to whom, but it's a well understood and mature and relative consensus at a regional scale around that plan. Economic development and the plans further to the right of the page, there is less consensus and less mature planning. We probably have 20 different economic development plans within the metropolitan region. Every medium and large-sized local government has their own. There's a consortium of local government technical folks called the Regional Partners that have their own plans. There is now a fledgling private sector group called Greenlight Greater Portland that's attempting to develop their niche in economic development. And so we have difficulty prioritizing and coordinating our investments regarding economic development because there really is no regional consensus around what the priorities are. And so we would hope that those efforts coalesce and we get more consensus. The point I'm trying to make is that we understand that the investments are connected, that they can leverage each other. A really good investment in transportation can leverage economic development outcomes, can leverage housing outcomes that we wouldn't have leveraged if we didn't prioritize and connect quite as well with that investment. One of my favorite examples is the Green Line that just opened in Portland, the MAX line to Clackamas County. $1 billion-plus investment. It's in the I-205 right-of-way. It ends in a shopping center parking lot at the Clackamas Town Center. Why? It doesn't leverage as well as it could housing outcomes and economic development outcomes over the long term because it's located in the wrong place. Not that it isn't a good transportation investment. We didn't leverage the other outcomes well enough. Why didn't we? Because we needed to put up I-205 right away as local match to the federal dollars, and we needed $25 to $50 million of urban renewal money from the Clackamas Town Center Urban Renewal District to be able to make up the federal match. My point is that we need to get smarter about how we invest, and that's really what we're trying to accomplish. When we called it an investment strategy as a working title, it might have been a small mistake in the sense that I know you're going to hear today about policy and kind of the way we do business issues that inhibit development within the urban growth boundary also. So it's more than just the money. The money's important, and we need to get smarter about that, but it's also about policy and the way we do business. Last point about that, and then I'll try to close. We do business in the metropolitan region in what I like to call a hyper-pluralistic model. We have 28 general local governments within the urban growth boundary and maybe twice that many special local governments within the urban growth boundary, including school districts. It is not a model that lends itself to centralized decision-making. And So while we have some ability to coordinate and some ability with the Metro Council's ability to regulate, to bring people to the table, we really believe that our future lies in being able to engage our local government partners at some level of consensus around these issues of investment and these issues of prioritization if we're going to be successful at realizing the vision for 2040. And if we can, I think our goal is to take a 50-year set of urban reserve lands and make them last 100 years. That's an audacious goal, but I think it's one, if we can bring more lands online to get rid of the constraints either around brownfields or around lot aggregation or around infrastructure provision to the lands within the urban growth boundary, we can be successful at reaching that goal. That's what we're trying to do right now. We may very well try to be before the legislature with options about how either to allow local governments more authority to raise money, allow for different kinds of financing structures to be put in place that either exist today in statute and can be modified so that they can work in the metropolitan landscape, or perhaps even bringing ideas to you that have worked in other states but don't even exist in Oregon at this time. But I guarantee you we probably won't be before you if we're not in relative agreement within the region. It very seldom works for us to come down here and argue with each other before you on some kind of new tool that we might need to do what we think we need to do. So I guess our commitment from Metro to you is that the only time you'll see us is when we have relative consensus in the region about what to move forward, particularly regarding public finance, governance issues within the region, and also land use and how they relate to each other. You may very well see that from us in the next few years. With that, I'll close, and you can hear from others.
Questions? Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but...
Oh, it's no problem.
I was in a meeting last week, I think, where there was an audience member who was bemoaning the fact that Metro had been in existence for 30 years, and yet it's an organization that has not been duplicated anywhere in the country. And so I guess I kind of like to hear your feedback on that, and why maybe, or maybe people are doing it a little, taking what you've done and doing it differently, or...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beyer, I think I get that question about once a month.
Oh, good.
We have delegations from all over the world that come to ask us how we do what we do. And one of the questions always is, tell us how you got this elected body that actually has authority in a region, because we'd like to see how to do that. And in my experience in trying to explain it, it has almost come, it has come to me that a unique set of circumstances created Metro as an elected body in the region, in Oregon, historical circumstances. Very difficult to duplicate in other venues, those historical circumstances that brought Metro into being as an elected body. However, I have to say that the vast majority of folks who ask that question are desirous of our structure. One that comes to mind is Envision Utah in the Salt Lake area, where there were basically a private sector effort to bring coordination and a vision to that metropolitan area. And then once the vision was established with lots of work, the only way that they could actually implement their vision in any kind of authoritative way was to go to the state legislature. And they bemoaned the fact that they had to do that. No offense. But... they felt it would be great if there was some body that could implement their vision at the regional scale. I tell folks that the highest, best use of Metro as an agency is that if we convene the region around difficult problems that no one local government can solve on its own, and we can facilitate that dialogue to an actionable conclusion, which is not easy, then the best use of Metro is then to implement that conclusion, because there is some authority there. it's not an easy thing to do, but I think we have an advantage if the tool is used prudently.
Follow up?
Well, there is one, but I'm not going to ask it. Thank you.
Anybody else before we move on?
Okay. Thank you very much. We may have more questions after we hear from our other guests. So, Mr. Chandler, Mr. Shepherd, you guys want to come together?
Two sides of the same coin.
And then we're going to hear from Director Whitman.
Uh-oh.
After that.
No.
Welcome, fellas.
Chairman.
John, I've got you first on the list, but it doesn't...
Whatever it serves the committee's pleasure, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I would like to start my remarks this morning by imploring all of you to please buy a new house. Several, if you don't mind. They're inexpensive right now, and it would help us a lot. Any questions? That's my testimony.
Yeah, some order.
I appreciate that. Being passed around is a list that I've been... None of this is novel, I should point out. None of this hasn't been on the table in legislatures past. In response to the chair's discussion that he mentioned from last session, where he, in front of this committee and others, where we talked about the ongoing problem of resource land preservation, urban growth boundary expansion, urban rural reserves, and all that, one of the things, as the chairman mentioned, that kind of gets lost in that discussion is how to make the development occur more quickly, easily, and expeditiously in the places where we've already decided it should go. And if that happens in a better sense and more efficient way, that reduces the pressure on resource land. It reduces a lot of the squabbles on those boundary line areas. So what I've given you, and again, these are not, it's not an exclusive list, it's not a new list, it's simply things that have been talked about many times before. Now may be the right time to bring them back, put them on the table, and discuss how we could actually get more serious about the plan, Mr. Jordan said, take going from planning to doing. And one thing we're really good at in this state, it's not a metro exclusive, although they're competitive, is we're really good at planning. We are very not so much good at the doing part. And what we tend to do, and a lot of these are kind of on the general theme, of starting with the plan, talking about it a lot, doing a lot of maps, doing a lot of deciding at the very 30,000-foot conceptual level, and then doing it again at the permit counter. And then when a development application comes through, using that opportunity to revisit the planning and talk about whether or not we're serious about what we want to do. The number one item on the list here is also the number one thing that I think we could work on, and that's standing to appeal projects, which is really a surrogate for making the plans that are on the books workable, implementable, as they were decided. And if, frankly, if we don't have the right plans on the books, we got to go back into the planning again. But basically taking the zoning that has been decided upon and letting it go forward, if not unimpeded, certainly lesser impeded. There's law on the books now, and it occurred to me I should have mentioned this in the written testimony. I don't recall the citation off the top of my head, but it's a law that was passed by this body back in the mid-90s creating expedited land divisions. An expedited land division, as actually Mr. Bob Stacey in his previous incarnation working at the city of Portland, and I worked on this bill back during Kitzhaber 1, and we had, the idea there was if you had a piece of residential property that was zoned, let's say, 10 units to the acre, and you come in with a project that is at least 8 units, I believe it's 80% minimum density, 8 units to the acre, and ask for this process, you can get an expedited land division process, which is a 60-day turnaround at the local level, and no appeal. The only basis for an appeal would be fraud, collusion, something outside the lines. But by and large, you could go right through with a director's decision, implement the planning that was on the books. I still think that's a good idea. And the notion, if I was in charge, if you can suspend disbelief for a little bit, I would have the system, the pyramid we have right now is public input at every level. And I realize there's some in this room are going to disagree strenuously with this, and it's kept all of us employed for 20-some-odd years, so I don't mind that. But a lot of public input should occur at the planning level. When it comes down to the implementation level, there should be less and less public input as you go down that pyramid, if you will, to where you actually get to the time where a permit is being asked for. If that permit is in compliance with the zoning that's already been determined and the land use is already on the books, there really, I don't believe, shouldn't be a whole lot of public input. At that point, it should be, does it comply with the zoning on the books or does it not? If it does, it should go forward. If it does not, then it should not. And that's really what we're trying to get at with that first bullet point. Obviously, a lot of issues there, not exactly uncontroversial, but I think it's very important. next point I want to make, Mr. Chairman, is actually the last bullet on here. Another law that's already on the books. We passed this back in 97, I believe, and has been cheerfully disregarded by pretty much everybody, including us, I'm afraid. And that says that we ask the cities to please keep track of developments that are applied for, what the zoning allowed, what the developer asked for, and what was finally approved. It's only residential, it can be expanded to other types of property. So in other words, if it's a 10 unit to the acre zone again, and the developer asked for 8 units and got approved for 6 units, that's information we'd like to know, because that underbuild, what's often called, is what puts pressure on urban growth boundaries, perhaps unnecessarily. If the urban growth boundary is designed to accommodate, again, just for purposes of illustration, 10 unit to the acre development, and you get a whole bunch of decisions at 6 units to the acre, then in fact you've lost 4 units to the acre, which puts pressure on the boundary. The point of that particular legislation wasn't to say the project should or shouldn't be approved, but simply to gather the data, because we do an awful lot of, in addition to planning in this state, another thing we're pretty good at is arguing about stuff where none of the parties really know what they're talking about. I'm good at that myself, and it's not a bad line of work. It would be nice to have a fact or two if it's not inconvenient, and the whole point of this would be to try to get at some facts. And again, it's on the books. It needs to be implemented. There's no legislation really required. It could be fine-tuned. The law as currently written says every city, which means Metolius has to do it. Probably not necessary to go torture the smaller towns. We could probably adjust the number up. We could probably make it every other year. We could probably make it electronic. We wouldn't have to do it as written. But the point there, I think, is really critical to find out what it is that's happening, not just what we plan for, because we're basing our plans in the future on plans for the present, and the plans in the present may or may not be being implemented the way we think they're going to be. So actually getting some data would be a very good step towards moving towards a more efficient use of land inside the boundary. Next topic is the fourth bullet. A 5-year land supply requirement. Back again, the bill that we worked on with Thousand Friends and Farm Bureau and others back in the 90s to require the 20-year land supply. And that's, I think, a good requirement still, but what's happened with the 20-year land supply is that most of the litigation and the fisticuffs occur over years, and for that matter, urban reserves took that one step further to talk about a 50-year land supply, but all the fisticuffs and argumentation occurs over years 15 to 20, which are basically pretend years. You know, 15 years ago, we all thought we were going to be different than we were. I thought I'd have a full head of hair. Well, okay, 30 years ago, never different conversation. The focus needs to be on the short term as well as the long term. And by focusing exclusively on the long term, I think it detracts resources away from the short term decisions we have to make about infrastructure, community design, where things ought to go between now and the next market cycle, not necessarily now and the time our first graders graduate from high school. So I think that combination, having a different requirement on the books along with the 20-year land supply, would be very helpful to help everybody focus on what I believe is the most important part of it. It's not what may or may not happen way out in the future, but what's going to happen this year, next year, 5 years from now. And to have that constant discussion occurring would be very beneficial. It'd be a lot of work, and I'm not blind to the fact that a lot of this would cost money, which I'll get to here in a moment. Next item, second bullet, is the fact that people can derail projects for no personal cost. Again, a controversial issue. I remember hearing back in the 90s when we brought in a bill, right? I might have been the aggregate guys, I don't recall, brought in a bill to raise the filing fee at LUBA from $50 to $100, or $150, something like that. Fairly, I thought, modest, and we filled up hearing rooms. And I don't think we got it done. Having said that, it still kind of goes to that first bullet about standing. If we have a wide-open system, and any one of us in this room could appeal any project, any place in the state of Oregon, whether or not we had any particular stake, and it wouldn't cost us very much to do so, that's a recipe for mischief and a recipe for not actually implementing the plans that we have on the books. And as I said earlier, I'm not anti-citizen involvement. I am very pro-citizen involvement. I just think it tends to occur at the wrong places in our process. And you should be having people discuss what happens in their communities in the planning stage, not so much at the implementation stage. And we also, by having the process we have on the books, we reward individualized decisions at the damage to the broader general public benefit. That's always a tough straddle in any issue, whether it's taxes or land use. I don't mean to make light of it, but that is one we should work on. And the final point on the bullets there goes to the issue of certainty. Land inside of boundaries should be available. Wetlands is a perennial issue. I remember a long time ago talking to the Corps of Engineers on the notion that that we really ought to get some kind of an award in Oregon because we'd used urban growth boundaries. We had taken 98-point-something% of the state off limits to development, which meant that 98-point-something of the wetlands, environmental areas, habitat areas, you'd pick your environmentally sensitive area, were off limits to development, and therefore, A, we should get an award for having done that, and B, the stuff inside the boundaries, whatever was left, in that 1.something% that was then available for development probably could be let, we could let slide. It probably wouldn't be that important. And if you've got a wetland inside the boundary, technically speaking, it ain't a wetland. Same with farmland inside the boundary. Technically speaking, farmland inside the boundary isn't farmland anymore. The problem is, again, like I mentioned, we forget that we've already planned this stuff, we've already had the conversation, we forget that when it comes to the implementation, and we have situations like what I'm hearing from some developers, and very few that are actually doing something right now, is that we're running into wetlands issues where you're having to do a needs analysis. Well, theoretically, that needs analysis should have been done at the time the decision was made on the planning level. It should not be being done at the permit level. Last point I want to make is not on the sheet, Mr. Chair, members, and then I'll hush and take questions. On the money piece, Mr. Jordan mentioned this. Obviously, this committee isn't going to deal with financial issues, probably, but you're dealing with the issue right next to the financial issue. One of the biggest problems in implementing our plans, aside from the ones I've mentioned in terms of the process, but one of the biggest problems is the fact that there's no money for infrastructure, particularly roads. And I'm of the firm, and you may have heard this from me before, and I don't mean to hop on the soapbox, and I won't stay there very long. I'm of the firm belief that every city in the state is going broke, and it's just a matter of time. Some sort of larger jurisdictions can cover it up with cash flow. They still have checks left, but they don't have any real resources left because we've taken away the tools that allowed them to fund themselves. And we instead have gone to things like system development charges, which, A, are demonic and evil, and, B, are insufficient. To the cost. If you're dealing with infill on existing neighborhoods, for example, or refitting your industrial property, it's very difficult to do with a system development charge-based funding strategy because there's simply not enough activity to cover the financial obligations that you incur. And if you look at areas like Damascus or Washington County up in the metro area, Springfield in the Lane County area, pick your city, the big problem is there's no money at the local level to pay for the roads. There's no way to properly assess that back against the developers because there's not enough money there in the projects. And with things stymie. I would recommend to you two ideas for not necessarily this committee's work, Mr. Chair, but for other committees that you may be involved with next session. One is it is time, I believe, over time, to take a hard look at Measures 5 and Measure 50. That is a constitutional issue, obviously. It's not one you can do legislatively, and it's one where you would get pummeled by both sides. Having said that, those are, I think, dramatic impediments to the ability of the state to function because we've taken tools off the table and the local governments simply do not have the ability to raise their own taxes or not raise their own taxes. They're locked in. I don't know that that's the state of Oregon's business, generally speaking, if a particular community wants to raise its taxes to pay for a road. If you don't live in that community, it's certainly none of your business. If you live in that community, it obviously is. Under our current system, it doesn't matter. We all have said, no, you cannot. And with that impediment, I'm not sure how we move forward. The other idea, which I really like, is we need to give local government some skin in the game in terms of economic development. I was on the Revenue Restructuring Task Force, and there's in the appendix is an idea that we played around with. I'm not sure it has any merit. I'll mention it anyway. That is to invert the state tax structure in whole or in part so that the income tax would go to the local governments in whole or in part, the property tax go to the state government in whole or in part. Plenty of details. There's a whole speech usually involving a picture of honest pints that we could talk about. But somehow, whether that idea works or whether you give local governments an expanded ability to collect income tax revenue for jobs they help create or something of the sort, if you can change the dynamic so that a city or a county that does create economic opportunity, that does implement their land use plan in a way that gets jobs going in their side of their community, gets to keep some of the income tax revenue off of that, that would dramatically change, I believe, the psychology at the local level. It would change a lot of these procedural issues, would change the politics behind the procedural issues, because now the city or the county, rather than seeing a problem to be fixed, an infrastructure burden to be borne, would see an opportunity for revenue coming off of those housing developments, those shopping centers, those office parks, those industrial areas. Right now they do not. In fact, they get penalized in a lot of ways because the faster-growing areas tend to use local resources for fire, police, and other things, send the money to Salem when may or may not get it back in appropriate measure. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, those are some ideas. I would love to work with this committee, Mr. Shepard and others, on these next session. I think it is time to have this conversation. I'd be glad to take questions now or at the conclusion of Mr. Shepard's testimony.
Okay. Let's go ahead and take a question now. Vice Chair Krieger.
John, I've seen over the years a lot of what I consider frivolous lawsuits when there's appeals. They're designed to increase the cost of projects. They're designed to stall and make people walk away because of bureaucracy. Oregon is known for that, and I think that's hurt us on the legitimate places we could develop. I believe under LUBA they could award costs to the prevailing party, but never once have, my understanding is. If we were to say that the court shall, how would that affect the frivolous lawsuits when they know the one they're putting forward, they're going to lose it, but it's just a stalling tactic?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, I think would have a salutary effect.
Say it again.
It's a good idea.
It's being drafted.
I'll be darned.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
I just have an observation, Chair Clem. One of the critical issues right now is in Sandy, where they're moving forward with the building of the high school that was just approved by the voters. But the difficulty, of course, is that there is an objection, and my understanding it's because somebody wants to walk their dog across the property, and the school district has a closed campus. So that has gone through the process of appeal and is now being appealed, and it is now at LUBA. So I think it's an illustration of what you're talking about when we talk about appeals. So the second observation is that it's my understanding urban renewal is a useful tool for cities, and without it, cities would not be able to do a lot of things that they're able to do currently. But the pressure's on, and it apparently in some areas fire districts are becoming very concerned about their ability to continue to get the tax money that they need to provide fire service because of the urban renewal district. And so my observation is that there's another pressure that's coming, looming forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norman, to your second point, the issue of urban renewal, I will defer to other experts. My limited understanding is such that every time I get close to that issue, somebody from the cities and counties comes and whacks me and tells me to knock it off. But I think what's happened there is that my point about Measure 5 and 50, if you will, we have a pie. And the pie ain't any bigger than it was in 1990 or 1995 when those measures in 97. We simply are now figuring out urban renewal is a fancy way of slicing the pie different. But it doesn't increase the size of the pie. It's creative math a lot of times and some fairly rosy assumptions a lot of times, but it doesn't do anything for the fundamental underlying issue. And I think what you're hearing from fire districts and others is a reaction to that, and I think the reason that local governments are using that tool is because they don't have they can't get there from here.
That's right. That's
so it's a very toxic circle. With regard to that first point, and I should point out on the, unless the, I suspect what's really happening up there is that the dog's smoking cigarettes, so you probably ought to check on that. That's clearly why they don't want the dog on the campus. I think to look at the issue of appeals is you got to be a little more delicate than what I've talked about. Obviously, in a short hearing this morning, we can't get into the nuances of it. But to Representative Krieger's point, most developers, if there is appeal, and you'll hear this if a bill goes forward, most developers win. My guys win. We win the ghost loop. That doesn't begin to count the number of times when my guys just say the heck with it and walk away, or when we go from 10 units to 6 units, or figure out some other way of getting through the process. So there is, it's a very complicated issue. But I think the point you're making, Representative, is that if you have a project that has been decided upon, then it should have been decided upon, and derailing it at that point shouldn't be allowed because that's not good for the state.
That's costly to the project.
I'll come after. I'll chat with you after your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to that chat. First, I want to request from our administrator, our assistant, a tape of his.
The first 15 minutes of the hearing that
no,
you missed.
No, I don't miss that at all. And I always need a tape of Mr. Chandler, and I have to go back and slow it way down, so I know what he said. And secondly, to your point about your wish for hair, remember this region is part of your head. So you may have very well made your goal. Now, Mr. Chandler, because I know you love to recount the misery that your industry is going through, I want to ask you a question about these policy suggestions, all of which I found interesting. But you mentioned, as we all know, that there's a lot of developers who aren't working and just a few who are. So, having just taken a tour yesterday in my district of a mill and shown a graphic that reminded me in very depressing terms how deep this particular housing crisis is, there wasn't, according to their graph, way back in the 70s. There isn't a deeper one. We all know we're in trouble. This is worse than any housing crisis we've seen. So my question and my concern is there anything, as good as these suggestions are, that we ought to be looking at that would actually help us build more in metro areas and start the climb out of this ditch?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilliam, I'm depressed now. Thank you very much. Just blew through my morning dose of Prozac.
Sorry.
That's an excellent question, actually, and I'm afraid I don't have a good answer. Most of the problems plaguing us right now as an industry are federal, and they relate to the banking climate or lack of a banking climate, more specifically. It is almost impossible to get AD and CIMA, acquisition, development, and construction money out of conventional lenders. There's an article yesterday in the Builder magazine, which is our national publication, that more and more builders are looking to venture money. And the Wall Street funded builders, the big national companies, still have access to capital. So that there are some things. I don't know the banking regulations well enough. I don't know if there's some stuff we could do at the state level with state chartered banks. If you do CCBS, I've played around with some ideas, most of which probably won't go anywhere because I think FDIC at the end of the day still controls. Those of you with connections, obviously all of you do, with our congressional delegation would be very helpful. Beyond that, I think there are some things that the state can do that are primarily in the don't make it harder category. And it's hard to draft legislation in the negative, if you follow me, but it's the things that, as we're coming out of this, one of the concerns, for example, that we're worried about is that as developments that are in the pipeline expire, and we had a bill last session that didn't get exactly go anyplace, but we had a bill last session that would have extended any current development applications just in place going forward so that we didn't have to start all the way over. Cities and counties, I think, were willing at least to have the conversation. They weren't thrilled about it. That's one thing that would be helpful, because otherwise there's going to be a built-up lag because it takes a couple of years to get through the process. If you stop at the computer development level and your permits expire and you have to come back around, obviously then you get a whole free pass back to the land use system as well as all your engineering and everything else. That sort of an action may be very helpful to extend. But beyond that, frankly, we're looking for to this body into the agencies, frankly, to first do no harm. A Hippocratic oath of politics, I guess, that there's things we can deal with the federal stuff in good order. Hopefully the banking system will come around. If we're open to any creative ideas about financing that might occur, although last time I checked, the state wasn't in whole great shape, any more shape than the industry is. I do know that Treasurer Wheeler has an interesting idea regarding state funds and local funds in depository institutions mm-hmm. and being able to free up some money off of that. But that's also a federal, I think we'd require federal legislation, but I wish I feel badly because I wish I could come in and say, here are a series of bullets that you could shoot to help the industry out. And unfortunately, it is dreadful, folks. It really is. Building permit activity is about 25% of where it should be in a normal functioning market. And it's we don't see a whole lot of turnaround very fast. Other than that, I think everything's fine.
All right. Hear from Mr. Shepherd. Duke?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Duke Shepherd with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We are a federation of about 45 labor organizations, public and private, across the state of Oregon. And we have traditionally not been a party to Oregon's land use wars, and I think it is telling about the state of the economy and our industrial land situation that we're getting into them now. I was invited here to talk about a legislative concept that we're working on, and it's simply this, that when there is industrial land inside an urban growth boundary that's taken off the table, it should be replaced, because in this state, industrial land is as scarce a resource as much of the natural habitat that we have. If you develop a wetland, you have to mitigate it. Our look at this is, if you're going to take industrial land off the table, it's a scarce resource too, and you should have to think through and have some consequences to taking that land off the table. And what sparked this, and I'm not interested in litigating a local government issue at the state, but what drew us in was West Hayden Island in the Portland area, where for 27 years this had been 800 acres of industrial land for port development. And just in the last year, it was... as the port began to look at it as being down the road, 10 or more years from now, but sort of laying the groundwork for development, that it became a habitat issue. It became, this is pristine land that should not be developed, and it immediately almost went from 800 acres to 500, and now we're left working with industry and the port and others to hold on to the remaining 300 for development. Now that's, maybe the habitat issues are, maybe portions of that area should be preserved. We're not really debating whether or not the habitat is of a certain quality or not. The question is, after 27 years of land use decisions, including the recent urban-rural reserves process, where you're saying you have a 50-year supply of reserves, if we're going to count that 800 acres in at the front end to theoretically prevent some expansion of the urban growth boundary, and then after those decisions are made, start taking land off the table, then really what we're saying is we can't have job development inside the UGB, and we don't want to expand the UGB, so where exactly are jobs supposed to go? And I want to make a key point about our legislation is that the goal that we specify in the draft that we're working on, at least, that if you're going to replace land, it should be equal in quality, too, because while brownfield development is something that really should happen, it's fantastic, it is insanely expensive, it is very difficult to do, and simply saying, well, we'll take this land off the table and you can develop some brownfields, that's not a real trade-off. And we would like to see that if you're going to take 500 acres off, that you replace that with 500 acres that is equally served by infrastructure, by transportation, by utilities, so that when a local government's going through these decisions, they're making real trade-offs. And if you want to take the industrial land off the table, that's the local government's decision. Maybe that's the right thing to do. Maybe there are other priorities. But within the UGB, that land should be replaced, and we should be able to have some supply of industrial land that is ready to go and ready to be developed. And that's what we're working on.
Questions for Mr. Shepherd? And Mr. Chandler, aren't we also talking with the Oregon Business Plan folks about some concepts or ideas as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members. We've been working with the Oregon Business Plan, Duncan Weiss's group, who's expanding out their outreach within the business community to bring a number of ideas forward. And I don't know if there's anything in particular you want to mention, but I think you'll see a series of legislative concepts and discussions at the summit in December mm-hmm. on this general topic of what Mr. Shepherd talked about, what I've talked about, and the thematic, I think, with both of ours is, and particularly with, and I'm industrial land, folks don't pay my salary, but residential land is much more fungible. It is easier, and part of the reason that we've had the issues in front of us aren't they're annoying and oftentimes aren't fatal. With industrial land, they're often fatal because land with rail spurs, with port access, whatever it might be, is very, very difficult to replicate that. It tends to be one of a kind. And so we fully support the initiative that the AFL-CIO is bringing forward. We think it's an excellent idea. But the Oregon Business Plan, looking at a number of these sorts of ideas, are looking at infrastructure, transportation planning rule, which is probably a hearing all by itself to entertain ourselves with that one. The issue of streamlining permits, there's some really good examples out there at the local government level of streamlining permits, using more electronic permitting to make things happen more quickly. There's probably something the legislature could do to encourage that and incent it and maybe provide an opportunity for what's happening in Bend to be more familiar, other jurisdictions to be more familiar with what they're doing. Looking at Goal 9, which is the economic development goal, and putting some teeth to that, I should have mentioned during my testimony that there is a five-year land requirement in Goal 9, but it's very squishy, and it's in rule, not statute, and it gets honored in the breach. And over the years, when we've had this conversation, people point out and say, well, there it is. As Mr. Shepherd indicated, it doesn't really hold up all that well. So what you're going to see this session is a number of groups that haven't necessarily worked together historically, not because we were arguing, but because we simply didn't, that I think we'll be talking to you collaboratively about issues of economic development and land use and land supply and permitting next session. So I think it'd be a very valuable conversation. And now with the economy down, you don't have the pressure of go, go, go. We actually, one good side of this is we do have an opportunity to be a little more thoughtful about what we'd like to see happen when things do come back and maybe get some of the groundwork laid for the recovery, which apparently happened a year and a half ago, but they forgot to tell us. I can't be the one who thought that was funny.
I had asked my mayor to come. She's unfortunately at a League of Oregon Cities conference today, but she's particularly well-known in this area for helping redevelop
you know, within the UGB, parts of town that needed attention, and you know, making things like rocket dockets for development and one-stop shopping for permitting. And unfortunately, she could not be here. So I wanted to show her off a little bit before she retires in 3 months. Anybody else? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Director Whitman.
Good morning again, Chair Klem, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, the director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. It's always a tough act to follow my friend John Chandler. And he's laid out some really, I think, good ideas for consideration in terms of things that we might do to make sure that our regulatory system is not an impediment to development within our urban areas. I think that's a goal that we all share. In particular, I think the large point that he made that we want to encourage citizen participation in our planning efforts when we're setting broad policies at the local level for what our community should look like. But when we get down to permitting, whether it's permitting a condominium project or it's permitting an industrial facility, those planning decisions are supposed to have already been made. And the review that's going on at the local level really should be focusing on much narrower criteria and getting it through the and making a decision yes or no and getting it through the process more rapidly. The example of expedited land divisions that was put in place in the early 90s, I think, is a good one that would be worth thinking about as a concept to potentially apply to other types of permitting decisions made at the local government level once the planning decisions have already been made. The big elephant in the room, though, I think, is one that John also mentioned, and that is the whole notion and the whole need for finance, in particular finance for infrastructure in our urban areas. Without the right tools to put in place the needed streets in particular, but also sewer and water in our urban areas, we're just not going to see the type of development that we're trying to promote. There are big challenges there because the main problem is, I'm afraid to say, Measure 5 and Measure 50. That's an issue that was front and center for something that you may have all forgotten about, but the Big Look Task Force on Land Use Planning really identified that, along with the Revenue Restructuring Task Force, as being issues that are key to making our communities work in Oregon. A little bit more narrowly, again, I'll take this opportunity to talk about a couple of things we're working on at the agency level as possible legislative concepts, again, depending on the okay of whoever our governor is for these concepts. But at the planning level, for what are called post-acknowledgement plan amendments, this is when cities and counties amend their comprehensive plans to make those broader scale planning decisions. Our system has quite a bit of complexity in it now in terms of the process for those and the notification process for that. And we've been working with a small group of local government folks and, again, interest in the land use system for some process improvements for that plan amendment process, and are working on a legislative concept there. Relatedly, another big planning decision that's made before you get anywhere near permitting is to set those urban growth boundaries. And we are also coming in with a process improvement bill for the whole process of procedures for how we amend our urban growth boundaries and how those get reviewed by the state after they're set at the local level. So we're going to hopefully have some improvements there as well. And then John mentioned a little bit the notion that, again, once planning decisions are made, particularly for housing, that permitting decisions should be more straightforward. We've actually had laws on the books
for decades now, both at the rule level, at the goal level, and then in terms of statutes called the needed housing statutes, the needed housing laws, that require local governments to have what are called clear and objective standards for needed housing. The notion is, once you've made the planning decisions about what you need for housing in your community, the standards for reviewing particular projects should be clear and objective. There shouldn't be a whole lot of fighting about aesthetics or other types of subjective criteria. Those are existing requirements on the books. We've had a number of court decisions over the years that have clouded exactly how those work. And so a third concept that we're working on legislatively is a cleanup, if you will, clarification of those requirements in state law for clear and objective standards for housing that we'll be bringing forward. So a lot of focus on process improvement. Again, we can't do much in terms of the banking industry, and but we can at least make sure we are not creating impediments to development occurring, particularly where we want it to occur in our urban areas. So we very much agree with that focus. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Dirk DeWittman? Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. So this is going to be a big priority for this committee going forward. It's clear that there's lots of groups working on their own legislation, but I want to do something over the next couple months that is more focused on one committee bill that incorporates a lot of these ideas. People are certainly welcome to continue pushing their own legislation. But between the agency, and I know Landwatch is working on something, and the home builders and AFL-CIO have something. So what I'm going to do is establish a working group, members of this committee, along with some of the folks that have talked today, for the purpose of developing some of these ideas, or maybe start with all of them, and we'll see what comes off the table into a committee bill for this next session. And so I want to ask, I'm going to appoint Vice Chair Van Orman, along with myself, Representative Gilliam, from this committee, to a working group. Mr. Chandler, Mr. Hagedorn, who's really quiet in the corner, Mr. Shepard, Mr. Kanzler, Senator Chris Edwards, who wants on it, and Director Whitman, to work on this over the next couple months. And other folks are certainly welcome to come. I know that Peggy Lynch would kill me if I didn't have some sort of league representation and Thousand Friends, and Sean Gillians, wherever he's at, and League of Oregon Cities. But for now, those will be sort of, depending on how big the table is, around the table are the people I named, and in the room can be others, of course, since this is a public process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
How big will Representative Van Orman's role be?
Bigger than yours.
He will probably... that's right. I think Vice Chair Van Orman is letting that...
I'm going to show up.
That's a pretty stupid question, really.
For that support, Mr. Chairman.
He's my good friend.
He's still figuring this whole thing out. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, sure. Yeah, Michael, do you want to come back up and chat with us about industrial lands a little bit more? Good. 5 minutes.
Very, very short. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Mike Jordan, Metro Chief Operating Officer. I wanted to emphasize a couple of things that are going on at the local level that may be models, particularly regarding industrial lands. We're making recommendations in the context of the Metro Council looking at an urban growth boundary adjustment this fall, amendments to our code, which would require some different things from local governments. For instance, Mr. Shepard mentioned the issue of dilution, land being used for other uses. We're recommending to the Metro Council that there be some expansion for large lot industrial land. It's the segment of the economy where Hillsborough doesn't compete with Gresham, but the Portland metropolitan region competes with Austin and
Frankfurt and Singapore. And we've established, with the help of lots of folks from the private sector and some consulting help, that there is a market inventory of these kinds of lots that make us competitive. And so we're recommending some increase to that inventory. You have a map before you that is labeled industrial, buildable land inventory for employment and industrial land, 2009. It's got a series of green and red dots on it, which delineate land that would be available in the near term and land that is more available in the long term. We have constraints on a lot of that land in the urban growth boundary, whether, as I mentioned before, it requires aggregation from small lots to larger lots, or it requires certain infrastructure, or it's a brownfield, much in the Portland Harbor area, for instance, that we need to remediate. That's going to require some investment. But what I wanted to propose is, on this large lot issue, we're also proposing a replenishment scheme within our code, which would say, if a local government tells us that one of these large lots they've issued permits and it's being built on, we would start a clock for us to look first within the urban growth boundary to see if there's an ability to either remediate what brownfield or aggregate or provide infrastructure to a site that currently is not buildable and bring it into the buildable inventory. Or if we can't do that within a year, I would be required to recommend to the Metro Council an urban growth boundary expansion to replenish that large lot. And we're looking to put that in code at the local level, and so it may be a pilot experiment that you may want to look to regarding the notion of industrial supply and the market availability of that land for job production. That was what I wanted to respond to. Mr. Chairman, any questions?
Commissioner Nato's with us. Are you here for this or for other things?
Yeah.
Okay, well, if you want to come to the work group, let me know. And then maybe you or Randy should be there. Either or. Whoever's available.
Thank you.
I thought about that.
Okay.
It doesn't sound
and we're on time.
No.
Amazing. Thank you all. This is, at least for me, this was sort of the highlight of today going into it, and I was not disappointed. We've got a lot of work to do in the next few days to get a placeholder, obviously, and then the next few months to have it ready. So, we are going to talk now about an unfortunately named insect, Drosophila suzukii, and my wife's last name with an extra I, and somewhat present near our fruit orchard. So we need Vaughn up here. Welcome. Yeah, sure. We've talked before during February, I think, maybe. Just identify yourself and tell us how things have been going so far with the research and the...
I'm Vaughn Walton. I'm a professor at Oregon State University working specifically on small and stone fruits. We, approximately 1 year, 1 month, and 1 week exactly from now is when we discovered this fly. And basically it attacks various fruits. Since then, we came here early this part of this year, and we requested some funding, which we were very, very thankful for getting, $225,000, which was supposed to basically be a stopgap funding amount, which would serve to help us bridge the period between 6 months and when this big SCRI grant of ours would come in. Just to give you a very brief feedback of what was done in the past 6 months, this project was divided into three components. The first one, because of the real concern of growers, was to do statewide monitoring so that growers can have an idea of which crops are attacked, where the flies are present. That was mainly managed by Tom Pierbolt. And there is an online map available. Growers can still go into that. Wine grape growers can at the moment still go into that and check and see if there are flies in their area. Then in terms of research, that was the other specific component, was to develop methods of control. And we have collaborators at the USDA who's specifically looking at chemical control. And they did some work in all of the small fruits, showing very, very good results. Then the third part was extension. And the extension component consisted out of direct interaction with growers, as well as a website. And if we look at the website and the interaction with growers, we got really good feedback. We got 50,000 downloads worldwide, 40-some countries. All of the states in the U.S. had hits to that website. We think that was very, very useful to give growers a very, very good idea of how to control this pest. To give you a brief feedback of what happened this season, it looks as if most of the growers, due to, we hope, the statewide monitoring, the extension, and the new control methods, managed to control this pest very, very efficiently. Very, very few growers actually had economic losses, except for the growers who didn't control. Now, there were some growers who did not control, and some of them had pretty severe crop losses. Just to give you a few figures, if we look at savings, I included a few crops, strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, blueberries, peaches, and cherries. If we look at a total value for those and a total savings, if we look at 1% savings on a seasonal basis, that would equate to $1.6 million in savings. If we look at a 30% savings, which would be a very realistic quantity, I know in California some of the growers lost 30% and up of their crop. Growers would have saved $45 million this year only. If we look at control costs, growers sprayed anything between 3 and 5 times per season this year. If we look at 3 as an average, the control costs for this pest, this is now physical, chemical control, it would be approximately $0.8 million. So the benefit from this funding, I think, was absolutely fantastic. We as researchers, and I'm sure that growers as well, have benefited tremendously. I'm convinced that this funding helped us secure the $5.8 million that we got for research over the next 5 years. Of that $5.8 million, we have $2.5 million coming to Oregon State specifically for research on this pest, and that will be for the next 5 years.
That's good news.
If there are any questions, I'd be willing to... I'll try and answer those.
The questions...
No, just congratulations on getting the degree.
Well, I'd like to thank everyone in here for their support as well. I'm sure that it was a big team effort. It was not only researchers, it was researchers, growers, and people in this room as well. I really appreciate that. Any other questions?
No, I was just glad I didn't see it in my cherries.
Me too. Okay. We had many sleepless nights, and I'm within the time limit as well.
Oh, I do have a question.
Representative Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I do have a question about weather, because we've had such unseasonably, cold weather, rain. Do you think that had an effect?
Most definitely, I believe the weather did have an effect. We had a very, very cool early season, and that kept the numbers relatively low. If we look at the crops that I just mentioned, strawberries were virtually not affected. Very few growers actually had to go out and spray. And that's the earliest crop that we have. Cherries, the same thing. Very, very low numbers initially. Now, if we look at a warmer early season, we're doing developmental studies now. It makes a tremendous difference in terms of development and reproductive potential. If you have high temperatures, your reproductive potential goes up significantly. So instead of having virtually zero flies in May, we could have a totally different situation next year.
Okay, thank you.
So luckily we've got some funding that we could deal with that, and we'll make our best efforts to deal with the problem.
Thank you.
Real quick
question.
Yeah.
So the chemical that was used, is it something that was readily available? I mean, we didn't have a big problem, and it was something that turned out to be effective and was already being used by the people?
Yes. So the question was about the chemicals. Basically, our plan was to first trial chemicals that are currently available. We identified a handful of chemicals that proved to be very, very efficient, and these were both conventional as well as organic compounds. Our biggest problem at this moment is that we only have one organic compound that's available, and we're working specifically to look at getting some more organic compounds available for the growers in the home garden type markets or the UPIC type situations. So, and the thing is, luckily for us, this is a pest that can be dealt with pretty easily with chemicals initially. Right. So the next step would be to move to softer options. Our next steps would be specifically to decrease our pesticide use and to use pesticides that have less of an economic, less of an environmental impact.
Thanks.
Hey, sorry, just one of the challenges, though, on pesticide use is, isn't the life cycle of the bug such that during the interval, particularly on some sprays, that you can't spray those prior to harvest, that they still will reproduce a few times even during that period when there's really no spray allowed of a certain intensity?
I think the problem or the advantage that we have is it looks as if we use those compounds correctly, if we target them early in the year, in the season, and we do repeated applications spaced far enough apart, you can keep the numbers low enough. So basically, we're preventing them from overpositing in the fruit. We're spraying the compounds before the damage or before the eggs are actually laid within the fruit.
Mm.
If you can keep those, it looked as if we managed to keep those numbers low enough so that you could prevent overposition, which would basically be like an insurance policy to keep your fruit clean.
Mm-hmm. Mm. This is why, not that there's anything wrong with moving to less pesticides, but this is why I'm not a completely organic-only orchard believer.
With this, you're not going to be able to control it completely organically. The big worry with organic production is that we have one compound, you have an insect that have several generations per year. If you're going to continuously use one compound, you're going to get resistance pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And Drosophila, those species are very, very well known for developing resistance against compounds. So that's our biggest concern at this stage for the organic growers.
Yeah, no one likes having to buy pesticides. They're expensive, but you know what? You don't like losing your fruit either. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
And we are going to get a quick update on the fire season, and then we'll take a break.
We're ahead of schedule.
And Paul's not going to ruin that for us, I'm certain.
Yeah. We'll try to quick.
We're okay.
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. I'm Paul Bell, Associate State Forester and Chief of Fire Protection, and next to me is Travis Medema, our Deputy Chief of Fire Protection. The department appreciates the opportunity to provide a brief fire season update to you folks, and so get right to the point with the weather. Fire weather for Oregon that we've received so far this season has made for an interesting summer for us. And hopefully in the next few days here, a shorter season too. For the months of June, July, and August, we have experienced the coldest summer in the past 17 years. We've experienced the 10th coldest June on record at the Portland Airport. We've had the single wettest June ever recorded on record, and the latest date in history for us to reach an 80-degree temperature for the first time in the calendar year, which was June 11th. The handout we've provided actually has kind of a series of charts, and if you move to Attachment A, this shows the rainfall and temperature records for the fire season up to date. And what I want to really point out is, if you look at the bottom half of that first chart, which is rainfall precipitation in inches, one thing that becomes difficult for us as we project out for the fire season is looking at those indices and running the models and trying to figure out what we need. But if you look at that February-March period, we went through a period where we had below normal rainfalls and some higher temperatures, and we lost a good portion of our snowpack. And at that time, we moved into a mode with what the projections were showing to be preparing for a much more active fire season that we had. And then as that moved on, we turned around and ended up with cooler temperatures, higher rainfall and snowfall, which ended up prolonging our snowpack into the fire season. And so kind of where I'm going with all of this is as we had to work through the allotment reduction process earlier in June, this provided us an opportunity to back off on our resources and take those savings. If you move to the next set of charts, attachment B, these are two charts that we call our energy release component charts, and these are for two areas in the state, one in the Prineville Sisters area and the other for Douglas County. And whether they've got a lot going on in them, the ERC is an index that measures moisture levels in various types of forest fuels and indicates the potential of the intensity of fires. Fires are more difficult to control when those ERC values are higher, and you'll see a red straight line that goes across the tops of the charts, which indicate our 97th percentile for those ERCs within those areas. And when we reach those types of points, that's when we have our most critical fire weather. So even though we had cool weather, we did end up with spikes in the middle of the summer where we ended up with some significant fire condition. Just real quickly, the dark gray line that kind of runs through the middle of the chart is our average ERC in those areas. The blue line is last year's ERCs, and the red line is this current year's ERCs, so you can see kind of how it tracks against the average and then also against the conditions that we had last year. And then the two light gray lines, one at the top and the one at the bottom, are historic averages of highs and lows. And we have had a fire season now where we've pretty much stayed contained within those lines. From that, I'll move into just our fire statistics real quick. As of September 19th, the department's fire statistics for human and lightning-caused fires have included a total of 589 fires so far for the season, 191 of those fires from lightning, and 398 of those fires are human causes. Lightning-caused fires have burned about 780 acres this year, and human-caused fires have burned about 5,481 acres for a total of just over 6,000 acres. This compares to our running 10-year average of 308 lightning fires for 20,000 or 21,000 acres and 626 human-caused fires for 4,600 acres. Would point out the largest human-caused fire we had this year came from the Rooster Rock Fire, which was just south of Sisters, which burned on state-protected land about 4,800 acres. Statistics are tools we work with where we go. I think what is important to mention real quickly is we look at 2009, which was somewhat of a similar fire season, maybe a little more active. Well, it was a lot more active than this fire season. But last year, our human-caused fire statistics and the number of acres burned were 4,000. So we did have a jump this year in those, and again, in large part because of one fire. Attachment C is just a chart which lists our large fire emergency costs so far to date, and this is dollars that get paid out of the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, and I included on the very last page our standard model that we use to show, so folks can chart where those costs come from. But the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund pays for the first $10 million of the $25 million insurance deductible we've had so far to date. we have about just over $6 million worth of charges that would come into that fund. So if we make it the rest of the year without any more fires, we will come in lower on those costs than what we've had in the last 6-7 years. I want to touch real quickly on our emergency board spatial purpose appropriation, or what we call the SPA, the dollars set aside that the department can hire severity resources with and come back in at the next legislative session and ask for reimbursement on those sources. After payment of fire insurance and fire season 2009 SPA resources, we have about $2.1 million that remains in that fund. For the 2010 fire season, pre-season contracts and agreements were executed so that we could acquire two large air tankers. One was based in Redmond, one based in Medford, one lead plane and three type medium-sized helicopters, one based in Pendleton, one based in John Day, and one based in Grants Pass. And then in addition to the cost for those things, we've had costs for our occasional call when needed helicopters, fire engine task force for move up during the peak periods of the year. But the long and the short of it is at this point our total cost for those resources are estimated to be at about $2.3 million, which is about $185 million over what we currently have in that. We hope by the time we get to the end of the fire season here and all the final costs come in that we will be able to bring that number down that we're over significantly. I just can't point out how important these resources have been. They're critical in helping us at initial attack and stopping those fires. So far this season, their tankers have delivered about 49 loads of retardant, 17 fires, or about 133 gallons of retardant, and the helicopters have delivered 458 buckets, or 116,000 gallons of water, to 35 fires. In summary, I just conclude, in conjunction with the weather, the department's initial attack forces, cooperators, and Oregon's forest landowners, today we've had a pretty darn successful fire season. Landowner support and cooperation has been critical to making our system work, and to point out, landowners annually pay a larger portion for the costs to support this system and contribute both time and resources to help us maintain the effectiveness of this. And either Travis or I would be more than happy to answer any questions for you.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Our general fund commitment to fires this year, counting the insurance policy and the SPA payments, is about $2.8 million. And the landowners have paid about $6 million. Is that about right?
The general fund commitment is for spatial purpose appropriation, right, which for the biennium is about $4.4 million. So fiscally, about $2.1 million. And then large fire costs this year, are against the landowner fund for $6 million.
Because we have talked a lot in this committee about having a 50-50 match. And the way it looks 50-50, but it has never been 50-50. It's really been because that first $10 million comes out of the landowner. They pay up front, and I just want to make sure that people really understand that in this state, unlike any of the states that surround us, the landowners are really contributing the most annually and continuously to this fire fund.
Correct. The system is set up very well, roughly to be 50-50 for the biennium for projected expenditures.
Right.
The actual expenditures, it's the way that the system works through the dollars, does put the higher costs onto the landowners paying into the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund.
Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we are a little bit ahead of schedule, but we have everybody here for the next deal. So why don't we take a 15-minute break, and we'll start a little early and try and get you out of here early. So we'll come back and start at 10:05 instead of 10:10.
Then I don't.
We'll break early.
Sorry.
and that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
I will recess.
Definitely
watch.
Okay, would we know where Emily?
being the Agricultural Committee. And we're down to the briefing and upcoming 2012 Farm Bill. Jeff Stone, Gail Agreeman, and Kathy Walker.
Want
to come up, please? Sure, I'll be back in just a couple minutes. Go ahead and identify yourselves. And
Mr. Vice Chair, I'm Jeff Stone, now Executive Director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. Been on the job for one day. They have not called for my head yet, which I'm very pleased about. Today we're briefing you on... Yeah, you have an email, Representative Gilliam.
Wow, well, his daughter hasn't read it yet.
Yeah. He doesn't read. He doesn't read his email.
I just want to say congratulations.
It's okay. If you want to say auto-delete every time, I think. But Mr. Vice Chair, today we're briefing you on the Farm Bill, and it's a federal appropriation every 5 years. The last Farm Bill, which was passed in 2009, was supposed to be passed in 2008. It was supposed to be passed in 2007. Is $464 billion, and that's in mandatory and appropriated dollars.
Thank you so much.
70% of the Farm Bill is in nutrition, so I want to be sure that we recognize that from the get-go. Today, we have different sectors that utilize the Farm Bill in different ways. We have the Farm Bureau, which we'll lead off with. Then we have the dairy industry that taps the Farm Bill in other ways. And then us, being a specialty crop, nursery and greenhouse industry, we've been very active in how we've done prosecute our Farm Bill agenda. So I'd like to give you enough time that you can ask us questions, because the next one, the next Farm Bill, is starting to be worked on right now, and it is scheduled to be considered in 2012. In federal terms, that's tomorrow, in terms of trying to get everything prepared, because it's a very complex piece of legislation and has some controversy to it at times. So I'd like to go to Gail Green, and then we'll go forward with there with your indulgence.
That'd be fine.
Thank you, Jeff. Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to speak before you today. My name is Gail Greenman, and I'm the National Affairs and Grassroots Specialist for the Oregon Farm Bureau. OFB is the largest agricultural organization in the state, and consequently our interests are very wide and very diverse. The Food Conservation and Energy Act of 2008 is of great importance to Oregon's farming and ranching families. My comments today focus specifically on trade, producer support, and conservation Farm Bill programs in the current 2008 Farm Bill. It is important to note that all aspects of the legislation are important to Oregon agriculture. The Market Access Program helps launch and expand sales of the U.S. ag, fish, and forest products overseas. It encourages the development, maintenance, and expansion of commercial export markets for agricultural commodities. MAP uses funds from USDA's CCC, or the Commodity Credit Corporation, to help U.S. producers, exporters, private companies, and other trade organizations finance promotional activities for U.S. ag products. The program forms a partnership between ag trade associations and cooperatives, nonprofits, state and regional trade groups, small U.S. businesses, and USDA's CCC to share the costs of overseas marketing and promotional activities such as consumer promotions, market research, education, trade shows, and trade servicing. Producer support programs are also working well, making up just 12% of spending in the FY 2009 appropriation cycle. Commodity programs like direct payments, countercyclical payments, and commodity loan programs all generate income support for a wide variety of commodities, including wheat. These programs allow farmers to benefit from the market, but also allow for some reliable income during times of low prices. Reforms in the 2008 Farm Bill included new standards for farm commodity and disaster program benefit eligibility. Exceeding income caps disqualifies producers from receiving payments. In addition, farm payments are directly attributed to individuals as opposed to corporations and partnerships, and we believe that these changes will improve transparency and accountability. As you know, the fruit and vegetable industry is a very important part of Oregon's agriculture. It's a very competitive and fragile industry, and it's impacted by spikes in planting, production, weather, availability in labor, and foreign competition. The fruit and vegetable industry has neither asked for nor received commodity-specific program payments, but the trade-off has been planting prohibition on base acres under the commodity title of the Farm Bill. The 2008 Farm Bill also expanded the Specialty Crop Block Grant Program. This program provides funds to state departments of ag for the purposes of enhancing competitiveness of U.S. specialty crops in areas of marketing, promotion, education, research, and nutrition. Also important to note is the significant investment made in this program in the 2008 Farm Bill, which is a total of $466 million over 10 years. In 2009, the Oregon Department of Ag submitted a state plan to USDA that included 24 projects totaling approximately $1.5 million. One example of those projects is an early market development and introduction program, which will allow ODA to work with experienced export companies and position quality Oregon specialty crops focusing on potatoes, onions, pears, berries, cherries, hazelnuts, and nursery products in Russia, Southeast Asia, India, and the Middle East. In 2010, while these projects are still pending final USDA approval, ODA has once again submitted 24 projects for a total of $1.7 million. I would be remiss not to mention the conservation title within the Farm Bill. These programs in the current Farm Bill are extremely important to Oregon. Not only do they strengthen the ties farmers and ranchers have to their land, but they also promote and assist improving and enhancing those surroundings. Significant investments towards conserving and improving soil, water, and wildlife resources in Oregon are done through the conservation title. Programs like the Ag Water Enhancement Program, Conservation Reserve, Environmental Quality Incentives, Wetland Reserve, Wildlife Habitat Incentive Programs bring a tremendous benefit to the state. Each program provides producers with an avenue to obtain a specific conservation goal, and these goals were met in 2009 by bringing combined $61 million to the programs I just mentioned. Providing producers a choice of a wide range of voluntary conservation and environmental programs creates multiple benefits. It allows land to remain agriculturally productive, which in turn creates a situation where land can be passed down from one generation to the next. Farmers and ranchers aren't getting any younger. The average age of a farmer nationwide is 58, and in looking through the county, by county, the 2000 census data through USDA, it looks like that average age of 58 would be applicable to Oregon as well, which is an improvement because in the prior 2002 census data, our average age of a farmer was actually a little bit ahead of the nationwide average. One thing to note is it's becoming increasingly difficult to attract young people back to the farm. The interest in lifestyle certainly doesn't present itself as the problem. It's the ability to raise a family while providing everyday needs. The long-term consequences of this are daunting, and it reinforces the need for continued investments in the rural development title of the Farm Bill. The backbone of any nation is the ability to provide its own food, and without continued agricultural output, our nation faces an all-too-serious threat of depending on foreign fresh foods, vegetables, and meat. This is an exciting time for U.S. agriculture. So much of what happens in Congress has a direct impact on our industry. As farmers and ranchers continue to utilize cutting-edge technology, yields will increase while maintaining our international reputation for providing Americans with the lowest cost of food in the world. It is with sincere gratitude that I thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today.
Chair Clement, members of the committee, it is indeed a pleasure for me to be here today. My name is Jim Cron, and I am the Executive Director for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. And I'm going to talk a little bit specifically about our industry, but many of the things Gail referenced would lap over into our industry also. Beginning in the last 2 months of 2008 and still as of today, our industry has had the lowest prices per hundredweight that we've ever had in history. We had a 60% reduction in price that are paid directly to producers. And it's extremely important for you to understand that what you and I pay in a grocery store has really very, very little connection to what the producer is paid. So through that time period and with the process that was going on with reduction in equity and those sort of things, people going out of business, we found a situation where our industry not not only here in Oregon, but U.S.-wide, was at a very, very critical point. The President and the Secretary of Agriculture put together a Dairy Industry Advisory Committee. It has 17 representatives throughout the United States. I happen to be one of those. And we meet regularly in Washington, D.C., and the purpose of our committee is to look at dairy pricing and put together a new process that will be used by the dairy industry, and this will become part of the Farm Bill. And obviously, it's not quite that simple, but it's extremely important to understand that as our industry became higher level in exports, the variability in our prices became extreme. From $20 a hundredweight down to $9 a hundredweight in a period of 3 months. And at that same time period, cost of feed, corn, was accelerating at an unbelievable rate. And that is mainly due to the production of ethanol. And unfortunately, those two dynamics didn't work out too well, and still haven't. So the mission of this committee that I serve on is to reduce the variability in prices. We'll never end that totally, but reduce variability. And the second piece of that is to increase prices to producers U.S.-wide. There's a number of ways that can be done. The variability aspect can be handled by some sort of production controls. By that I mean if we're looking at a price spread, so if we look at what a producer gets paid for milk and what the cost of production is, if that price spread is in that $4 to $6 range, then probably we have an adequate amount of production. If that gets lower than that, we've probably overproduced. And so what our committee is heading towards, I hope, is a production control system that will be mandatory to all producers. Many people say it should be voluntary. Well, frankly, voluntary means those who will, and those who won't, and the won't kill the will. So voluntary doesn't work. So our hope is that this mandatory production control piece comes into play. And in addition to that, our price is set in several ways. One of those is through the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And many products are bought and sold there. On the dairy side, there will be an average of 2 to 4 people that do the trading on a day, and that trading lasts no more than 7 to 8 minutes. Individuals can buy and sell for the same company or multiple companies. Usually it's a very small number of companies that trade, 2 to 3 at max. And it is legal to manipulate prices through that process, not illegal, okay? Our price has been extremely manipulated through that process, and so we are looking at what's called a competitive K price would be the basis of pricing, along with the margin issue I spoke about a little earlier. Competitive pay price would require all processing plants to report monthly what they paid for milk, okay? Every plant in the United States, and that doesn't exist today. A very few amount of plants would be the ones that would report. So an example, in the state of Idaho, where the price of milk is extremely low, if those plants report, and let's say some of the plants here in Oregon don't report, what happens in that particular month is the reporting plants would have a very low price. We get everybody, and it can be average. So we will make a final report. I'm one of three people who will be authoring the report. We will begin tomorrow evening. I'm flying out for D.C. in the morning, and we will begin putting that report together. The first report will be a broad-based report. The second one will be more specific to the Secretary of Agriculture, and that will be what he and the President move forward on dairy pricing in the next Farm Bill. We are aware, without any question, that if this costs any more money, in any shape, way, or form, just like here, it's not going to work. So we're doing everything we can to reduce costs to the government and make this more of a producer issue, and we believe under that premise that this is something that can move forward. The unfortunate part is we have a tremendous amount of resistance from the processing industry, because obviously if I own Kraft or if I own Dean Foods, the profit is made by what my input costs are. And input costs is the raw milk product that is sold to them. And so we have tremendous resistance from them in both the reporting issue, the mandatory supply management issue. There's tremendous resistance. And so that will be a battle that'll occur in Congress. And obviously, the International Dairy Foods Association, who represents that group, will be coming with all guns a-blazing. And we hope we have ourselves set up to make this that something that works, and hopefully our industry as producers will stick together. We have a tendency to want to, like any other agricultural commodity, not agree. And low prices get people to agree much quicker than words. So we're getting there more than I expected we would, but again, prices have been much lower than they have in the past. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of perspective from the individual aspect and what's going on within our industry. But again, it's important to remember that many of the things Gail spoke about are also used in our industry also. Thank you.
Questions? Jeff, you're going to wrap up, Stella. Any questions at the moment? Representative Roebling.
The last farm bill that went through, one of the concerns I had is that, and maybe you'll address this more, Jeff, specialty crops seem to take it in the shorts with respect to how the bill is organized. And milk has done okay, but not really that well. It's stuff that we don't produce as much here. You know, the cotton, the corn, the other kinds of stuff that we do stuff. Is that still a part? I mean, is this bill still skewed towards some of the other farm issues as opposed to a state like Oregon that has smaller farms and more diversity in crops? Is that still a problem, or is it getting a little bit better?
Well, I could certainly address it if you wanted to.
Go ahead.
You're right. The specialty crop title is typically and has been a little bit smaller than if you're referencing the commodity title. I think in past farm bills in 2002 and 2008, you've seen incremental increases in the strength of the specialty crop title. Producer support programs as a whole, which specialty crop would be brought into, are 12% of the overall spending in the farm bill. So this year, FY 2009, it was a $70 billion spending level. 8.7 of that went towards producer support payments. 71%, and that has risen a little bit from 66 in prior years. But 71% is obviously nutrition. So I think, you know, As we progress forward, certainly we strengthen the specialty crop title each and every time. I think it's really important to remember, and what a lot of people don't realize is that when we're talking about the traditional commodity programs in the Midwest and the South, they have planting prohibitions put on them based on those direct payments and countercyclical payments. And I don't know if there's any way to measure that impact, the impact that would have, the removal of that would have on Oregon. I can only imagine that it would be drastic if we remove those planting prohibitions on those states.
Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative Roebling, I think it is important and Gail mentioned it, but a high percentage, and I think she said 70, is food and nutrition programs. So it's not the agricultural direct payments that people would talk about. Again, from the dairy perspective, we receive very few payments. Most of those are dollars that are paid. The payments we do get are dollars that are paid in by producers to the government and then turned back over to producers through a program that exists today. So we get very little direct subsidy from the government in any shape, way, or form.
Mm-hmm. So follow up with that one with respect to milk in particular. You're trying to get that variation to get narrower.
Correct.
And shouldn't the nutrition part of this bill help that? I mean, the government is a fairly large buyer of Can that be used in some way to help you meet your needs as well?
Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, yes is a simple answer. But nothing in milk pricing is simple. We have expanded exports. When the economies in the United States and other parts of the world crashed in the end of 2008, we were at 12% exports. Okay. And keep in mind, it takes about 1% excess production for our price to take a huge drop. We went from 12% to 4% exports in a period of about 4.5 months.
So that's where the
and so yes, we do sell a lot of product to schools and some of the food and nutrition programs, but they've if you would go back 20 years or 30 years or 40 years, that percentage was much larger than it is today.
Okay.
So it has less impact today than it would have in the past.
Thanks.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a quick question for you, and it's a little bit of a digression, but I got permission from the chair. So I know we're looking at big picture farm bill stuff, but could you just, while you're here, and you did mention you were giving us an update on your industry. When we took that tour earlier this summer, the whole lagoon DEQ water resources issue, could you just tell the committee a little bit about what happened? I'm hoping we can change that by rule, but maybe it's something the committee needs to know about.
Okay. Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, I thought you were an expert on the dairy industry. Maybe we didn't do that good of a job that day. But yes, the issue is the liquid portion of animal manure is stored in what we call a lagoon, and it is a lined unit. Some of them are quite large, and that allows dairy producers to apply that liquid at times when the crops are growing. So there isn't, we call it applying in an agronomic manner, so there isn't runoff and those sorts of things. What had occurred is, in a bill that was passed last session, I believe, there was a portion of that bill that stated that all liquid impediments, including lagoons, were required to have an inspection by water resources and to assure that the dikes on the lagoons were not going to leak. In the dairy industry, every dairy gets at least one inspection through our CAFO program annually. And this is also one of the things they look at. In addition, there was a fee put upon this. I think it was $50 or $100. And again, it's not a lot of money, but it seems rather silly to us. When you have one agency doing something and you have another agency that's going to do the exact same thing. And so, I mean, again, it's more of a message than it is the amount of money, but it seems a little ridiculous to us. So, and we had that conversation at a dairy a few weeks ago, a month ago, maybe it was. So, so hopefully that explains it.
It does.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Another little project for the committee.
Representative Van Orman and then Winger.
In regards to the conversation about the USDA nutrition program, since they are required to serve milk, I was curious about your statement that portion of the business has decreased. Is that what I heard?
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, not exactly, okay?
Okay.
Let me say it again. When we look at where milk went,
okay,
let's say 30 years ago, because we had maybe 1% export at very most, and I don't know what the percentage of food and nutrition programs would be, but, you know, whatever percentage. Let's say it's 1%. That percentage hasn't increased, where the percentage of export has increased a lot. So the percentage of impact from food and nutrition is smaller. I don't mean to say it's not important, okay? Because it is important. So.
Okay, thank you, but it helps me understand what you say.
Yeah, it absolutely is important, yes.
Representative Winger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gail, give us some
I'm just curious as to whether or not the next farm bill fiscally will be smaller than the previous farm bill.
Well, we certainly hope not. if you look at farm bill spending right now, based on the FY 2009 spending year, it is 0.5% of the total U.S. budget. If you combine all USDA programs together, that it's less than 5% of the total U.S. spending budget.
Can you put that in dollar amount?
Not on total USDA programs. I could get that to you on the Farm Bill program. FY 2009 was $70 billion. So, and breaking that down, 49.8 went to nutrition, 8.7 towards farm commodity support payments, 3.5 conservation, 7.9 in crop insurance, and 0.3 for export programs.
Just a final statement on that. I just think based on the revenue scenarios that mm-hmm. the federal government is facing,
sure.
What I would say to you is not because it's the ag. I would say it to any and every mm-hmm. department of the United States government. I think you should be anticipating less.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage you to be thinking about ways to have a smaller farm bills going forward, because I just don't think that anybody can expect even flat funding in the foreseeable future.
So I think everybody in the industry is very well aware, especially given that the 2002 farm bill was certainly written in the highest watermark year that this country has ever seen, and that definitely affected conversations for the 2008 farm bill, and I would expect it would affect those same conversations are going to be had for the 2012 farm bill. As an industry, as an organization, I anticipate that those will be some very serious conversations that we will have, especially as our policy process begins for the 2011 year. We will have more of an idea of where our policy will go after January, after we convene nationwide as a convention. But I would agree with you that, you know, we are realistic and we do understand the fiscal implications. We would just hope that, and like you said, I know that you would say it to any industry, and probably any industry would have the same response, but, you know, we believe that this is a critical issue. It is one of the largest bills in terms of discretionary spending in Congress, and so we will certainly advocate for the programs that are near and dear to Oregon producers.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. But I would say that for me, Homeland Security is about a population that is well fed mm-hmm. and is nutritionally sound.
Mm-hmm.
And as a administrator of the child nutrition programs for multiple years, I can't tell you how key nutrition is for children.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have a vital interest in making sure that our population is well fed.
Mm-hmm. Well, in line with our next topic as well, one of the things that I look for in the Farm Bill is the allowance for regional sort of preferencing, because this committee has been big fans yep. of the Farm to School program,
mm-hmm.
and part of the key to that is the federal match, which that was illegal until the 2008 Farm Bill, to be preferencing Oregon growers with federal money, and so we need to maintain and strengthen the ability to do that, because you know, some of us really like to put local foods from Hood River and other orchards
in and around
little right.
school children.
Not me. I'm just thinking about it. Should I do my conflict of interest right now?
So noted.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Jeff.
Yeah, Chair Clem and Representative Van Orman. One of the things, and again, I tried not to have my conversation be too complicated, but one of the things in our production controls program is that if a producer overproduces, okay, so let's say he's allowed to produce 100 pounds of milk and he produces 110, that 10 pounds of milk he will not be paid for. That money that milk is worth will go into a pot. And that pot will be administered by the dairy industry and will be used to buy product for food and nutrition programs, food banks, those types of things within the United States. So that could end up being a fairly sizable pot of money. And so that would go for cheese or milk or yogurt or any of those sort of things. So we're hoping that can all stay together, because that would be a huge positive for our state and other states too.
So before you wrap up, I just want to comment on the fact that, well, it's a national issue, so that's part of why we're seeing Gail, but the other part is Brother Cleve is currently across the street at the Salem Hospital, where his wife is in labor as we speak, and I just suggested to him that he perhaps name the little girl Jeff Stone, Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Nursery, Cleve. Just so you know, I just transmitted that as the desire that
I think his wife Julie would object.
I'm just throwing it out.
I'd object.
Mr. Chair, I thank you for the opportunity for us to bring this before you, and what you're seeing, and I'll touch upon these. You have my written remarks that I gave to Chairman Colin Peterson when he was out here with the Farm Bureau, dairies and nurseries, talking about this next farm bill. You're going to see potentially Representative Wingard a smaller farm bill, but what that does is it creates those plates that have traditionally been funded. You have the commodity folks, you have the specialty crop folks who desire a greater share of the specialty of the farm bill to compete for fewer dollars. And but how does the farm bill help? I mean, we talked a lot about how it impacts Jim's folks and Gail's folks. How does it affect nurseries? Well, there's a disaster component to the Farm Bill. And what we found after the 2008 storms that knocked down a lot of our hoop houses and create a lot of damage is that the Farm Bill and the way disaster relief is written is not conducive for the nursery and greenhouse industry. They look at it in terms of devastation to a wheat crop or to a devastation to a corn crop. They don't see it for multiple year type of industries like us. So that's also that creates a problem, because the Farm Bill didn't help our folks get emergency payments. But it also provides an opportunity for us to recraft the disaster part to help viticulture, nursery and greenhouse folks, but those specialty crop growers that normally do not find themselves, that it's hard for them to ask, but let alone get any assistance. In terms of what you heard with Brother Chandler earlier today, same things apply for access to credit, and the Farm Bill has a component for access to credit in farm loans. Gail already addressed the soil and water conservation portions, but on energy, there is a growing energy title there that really we want this next Farm Bill to provide cost share or some type of assistance for folks who become more energy efficient. We have Tom Fessler right up the road in Woodburn, who reduced his energy use by 75%, his natural gas use. To give you a sense, that would his savings on the grid power the town of Independence for a year. So that's one grower doing it because it made economic sense. He didn't have any subsidies for it, but he also had the ability to do it. So think about all those producers that, if they just had a little bit of help, just a little bit, could become more energy, water efficient, you name it. That, and that's part of the positive side of the Farm Bill that can really make things easier for the farming community. For us, there was the Biomass Crop Assistance Program, which was a great idea. In its application, though, it provided subsidies for transportation, which drew away bark out of the market and put it towards biomass facilities. We want to be supportive of renewable energies, but we use bark to ship our plants east because it's lighter than soil. So what it did is it created a market pressure and cost of production that was a lot higher. Chairman Peterson had no idea that that was the impact, mm-hmm. and he wants to resolve that. But that was a good, well-meaning part of the Farm Bill that had an unanticipated consequence. But so we always need to look at those, but not be afraid to do them. The last couple parts, and I'll be very brief, is pests and disease. We all know with the nursery and greenhouse industry that we're very dependent on exporting our nursery product outside of the state, but also outside of the country. And there are significant programs and mandatory funding that was put in the 2008 Farm Bill that helps our growers mitigate and reduce risk. So you've heard me talk about a systems approach, about using it like you would do with a can of tuna. You don't inspect the tuna can at the store. You have a series of production checks all the way through the production line to the very beginning. And that's what we want to try to do with the nursery industry, is to have those production sense and make it so you have reduced risk. And specialty crop grants. We pushed hard as Oregon to get a greater share of specialty crop grants to come back to the state. That's the right thing to do. Oregon has been underserved for specialty crop grants. We're very pleased with our relationship with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The OAN has applied for and received just last year $138,000 worth of specialty crop grants for pest and disease issues primarily, and taking our paper online book, our book for our product, and put it online as a greater marketing tool for Oregon. And lastly, especially, there was a creation in 2008 of a specialty crop title. That alone was set shivers through my good friends on the commodity side, but it's the right thing to do. And now it had mandatory funding of $1.3 billion. While that may not seem a lot in a $464 billion bill, it was a solid first step, and I think it's finally a nod to the specialty crop addition to the agricultural community. So with all that said, you have all these different programs. You have what the dairies want. You have what the farm community wants. You have what specialty crop folks. We work to get the wine growers written in to certain parts where us and the wine growers were not allowed to seek certain parts of assistance, federal programs, and it would seem ridiculous, and so we just put it in to the Farm Bill, and now all those folks have access to programs. So with that said, we appreciate your time. You asked what you could do when the Farm Bill comes up, and all these groups who work not only with you here in Salem, but also work in Washington, D.C., the wheat growers and others, have an aggressive program. We talk amongst ourselves, but it would be sure nice to have the agriculture community and the agriculture committee write positive letters to our delegation, to leadership, to say that this is important for our state. So there is a role for you to play, and we want to make sure that we don't bore you to death at this briefing and that you actually want to help us.
What chamber does it start in? Farm Bill, do we know? House, Senate?
Well,
in what committee?
Well, if you ask Chairman Peterson,
yeah,
the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, it starts in his committee.
Yeah.
And if you ask the Senate, it starts in theirs. But okay, they, I think by and large, Chairman Peterson's farther along, I think it will start in the House, yeah, and move on to the
Schrader's on that one.
Yes,
he's on that committee.
So last session, he called me right before session and said, "Look, I'd rather take my lead from your committee than other entities in the state of Oregon and government." So I think there's at least three of us who are in his congressional district, so we can certainly pay him a personal visit as well next time he's in town with ideas. He was soliciting us.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think you asked a very important question in terms of committees, and the Farm Bill does start in the agriculture committees in both the House and the Senate, but I think it's a really important point to make that I think every committee in both the House and Senate, with the exception of defense, the HASC and SASC committees, have some type of jurisdiction over the Farm Bill, and so that is also what adds to the time that it gets bogged down in.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? True. All right. Thank you very much. Congratulations again. Building duck. We'll be Boise State Saturday. I'll stop giving you grief. Okay.
It's Oregon State that's playing.
Oregon State's playing Boise State.
Yeah.
Let's hope they live.
Representative Buckley going to make it?
Coming down, we've called this off.
Okay. We're just going to wait a moment for Representative Buckley, who wants to join us for the next informational
cooler
item.
The cooler one?
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh,
okay.
You want to do the food hug?
He's going to have fun. He's going to have fun here with our committee, I'm sure.
He was looking over.
Well, the last time he came in front of the Ag Committee in 07.
Sure.
What was it about?
We'll do Food Hub, and he's just wrapping up a $3 billion deficit, so we'll move on to Food Hub and come back to CARES. Please, Deborah. You'll have to tell probably some people what Food Hub is and all about Food Hub. It's very cool.
You have a little Food Hub demonstration?
That was my understanding. Awesome. Oh, good. Because that's all I have for you.
Very good.
I'll just talk about food. I'm ready for lunch.
Would it be possible to get a glass of water?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Got to go test your own beer, indeed.
For what?
He stole your bike, too.
When Representative, what's the guy from Ways and Means?
We're on live mic, too, just so you know.
That's fine.
We're, anyway. Paul or something, Buckles?
Buckley.
Buckles?
Oh, yeah. When Buckles comes.
Oh, Peter.
Could
Peter.
You give the gavel back to Mr. Krieger?
Sure. Why not torment the Ways and Means co-chair? We don't want any bills to actually make it through, do we?
Nothing will change in life.
Got one or two through the last time we could go for zero. There's the key word. No fiscal.
No.
That's the magic word. All right.
So Chair Clem, member of the committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Deborah Kane, and I am the Vice President of Food and Farms at the nonprofit EcoTrust, which is based in Portland, Oregon. And yet this morning I woke up in Bend because I was spending some time with the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. And so I got to do that beautiful drive this morning. And so I'm just full of images of the most beautiful state in the country. So I want to thank you very much for your service, and you especially, Chair Clem. Because I did pass by the headwaters of Metolius.
Oh,
paid a little visit on your behalf. But today I'm here to talk about generating economic opportunities for agricultural producers in the state of Oregon. And I, my apologies, so I missed earlier portions of your hearing, but I did catch the tail end of some discussion about specialty crop block grants. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about Food Hub, which is the recipient of at least three rounds now of specialty crop block grant funding. So Food Hub is supported with specialty crop money through the Oregon Department of Agriculture, but also through the Washington State Department of Agriculture. And Food Hub is basically a matchmaking service for food buyers and food sellers. There is tremendous interest these days in bringing more regionally sourced or locally sourced food products into all sorts of different venues. And in many respects, Food Hub came as the result of one very simple conversation I had with Lisa Sedlar, who is the president of New Seasons Market, a chain of grocery stores in the Portland metropolitan area. And if you're familiar with New Seasons, you may know that they're relatively well known for their ability to find and procure regionally grown products. And yet even New Seasons was having a difficult time filling their shelves with all the local products they were sure were out there. And I had one of those conversations with Lisa, the fist pounding on the table. Why can't I just go to my computer, type in the word cranberry, and get a list of all the different cranberry producers in the region? And furthermore, I need to know who's got them dried and who has them fresh. I've already got fresh cranberries in my produce department, but I want dried ones for my bakery, for my scones. Why can't I do that? And I thought, well, why indeed? And so I went back to my office and typed in the word broccoli, for example, into Google to test the theory that Lisa couldn't find what she was looking for. And, of course, the first thing that Google asked me is whether I meant broccoli with two C's.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yes, thank you very much. And I was told that there were 4.2 million results for broccoli and that Aaron Broccoli was on Facebook. If I wanted to reconnect with my college sweetheart, I could do that. So I thought, well, I'll narrow my search, and I said, well, broccoli for sale in the state of Oregon, and I got 506,000 results. It took Google 0.27 seconds to tell me that. There's a broccoli lane in Roseburg where things are for sale. And then I said, well, broccoli farmers direct market in Oregon, and I got 34,000 results. And then I thought, okay, I'm not going to try to find a direct market producer. I'm just going to get that broccoli off the Sysco truck. Broccoli for sale, produced in Oregon, via Sysco. And I shot back up to 506,000 results. That, indeed, was the inspiration for Food Hub. Why can't we just sit down at a computer, type in the word broccoli, and find a list of broccoli producers in the state of Oregon? So, Food Hub was launched in February 2010, again with specialty crop block grant funding. Just last week, we received word from USDA that we received another round of funding, this time Rural Business Opportunity Grant Program funding, and much like my colleague in the dairy industry, I'll be getting on a plane tomorrow for D.C. because Secretary Vilsack would like to personally award Food Hub the grant check because it so closely aligns, the project so closely aligns with some of the current administration's goals as it relates to job creation in rural communities. So I thought that you might be interested in learning a little bit more about this national model that exists here in the state. So one of the very first things that folks do when they come to Food Hub is they browse. They'd like to see who else is in the Food Hub system. We currently have 609 members. It's a membership-based system, again, for buyers and sellers. It's not Fruit and Vegetable Hub, and it's not Meat Hub. It's not Canned Product Hub. It's all food products that you would expect to be produced in the state of Oregon. And you can search by type of business. So we could just look, for example, at the 236 farmers who are currently in the Food Hub site. And one of the nice things about Food Hub is that once you get a search result, you can narrow your search on much faster connections by distance from you. So I'm logged in as a Food Hub buyer. Food Hub knows my zip code, and therefore I'm geocoded against all the other Food Hub members. And so my list of farmers is going to get sorted for me based on distance from my operation. But let's go ahead and look for that broccoli farmer.
Let's look for tomatoes.
We could look for tomatoes, but with 600...
It has two C's, by the way.
It does, and Food Hub won't let me type it incorrectly, but it also won't point out my mistake for me, which I really appreciate. So I'm going to look for broccoli. And one of the things that's nice about Food Hub is that we don't presume which way you'd want to go in your search. So we're telling the user not only that there are 19 sellers of broccoli in the Food Hub system today, but also that there are 15 buyers. So you can imagine a scenario where a broccoli producer is very interested in doing, you know, list creation or trying to figure out, you know, who might be interested in buying their broccoli so they can reach out, as well as that buyer who wants to find the producers. Now, I know, for example, let's just say that I'm a buyer and I want to find those sellers, so I'm just going to go straight into the farmers. But one of the other things that's nice about Food Hub, if you see on the left-hand side, is that you can continue to narrow your search results. So I could be looking only for certified organic or only Food Alliance certified broccoli producers if I so chose. Or I could go down to variety, I could go down to form, packaging, preparation, and when that broccoli is available. So let's just pop in to Wintergreen Farm, just to give you a sense of how all the different profiles are organized. Buyer and seller profiles are generally organized the same way, but in the case of sellers, of course, they're sharing their seasonal availability chart from January to December and the list of all the different products that they have for sale. In the case of a buyer, it would be their buying plan, what they typically buy, and at what time of the year. All the information that buyers might need to know. Is there a minimum order amount for this farm? Do they carry liability insurance? How many acres are they on? Right now, acreage is a proxy for production capacity or volume. Who are they associated with? Are they members of the Farm Bureau? Are they members of various coalitions? And then finally, at the bottom, one of the things that's also really nice about Food Hub is while it works really well for direct marketers, those producers who are willing to load up a truck and come into town, it was also designed to accommodate producers of much higher volumes who continue, as well they should, to rely on mainline distributors to move their products. So in the case of Wintergreen Farm, you see that they're available through several mainline distributors, including Sysco, Provista, Merlino, etc. So, Representative Clem, I thought that you might be interested in hearing about the degree to which school food buyers are now increasingly using Food Hub to find regional and local farmers. So let's just take a peek. It looks like we have 49 K-12 schools currently enrolled in the system and 20 pre-K facilities. Which is really exciting.
Yes, it is.
It is. And the good news is that it's working. Again, we'll just pop into a profile, give you a sense of Beaverton. I love Beaverton's profile, how to do business with us. Unlike some major school districts in the Pacific Northwest, each of our 50 schools orders in all of their own groceries.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Produce, bread, milk, and other items from local vendors. Everything is delivered to each individual site. As we do not have a central warehouse, here are some of the challenges with farm-to-school programs. In looking to get a greater variety of local goods into our schools, this may seem challenging, but we are willing to look at all opportunities. So Beaverton is a fantastic example of how schools are using the site. FSA is a distributor for our groceries they share. So you've seen profiles, we've searched for products. One of the things that is actually one of the most dynamic aspects of the site right now is actually the marketplace. So the marketplace is becoming truly a Craigslist for the regional food community. And you'll see the marketplace used for time-sensitive opportunities, both producers wanting to let you know that they've got great, Representative Van Orman, you know, late-season tomatoes. Here's someone who's got 2,000-plus pounds of heirloom varieties that they want to move. And so they're using the marketplace to let all the food buyers know about that. And then you'll see Woodburn School District letting the entire Food Hub community know that they're looking to purchase carrots from a local farmer for the beginning of October. And they do about 5,000 servings, and thus will need approximately 700 pounds. So all the carrot producers in the state of Oregon have precisely the information they need to figure out whether or not they might be able to work with the Woodburn School District. That, in a nutshell, is Food Hub. The final thing I'll show you is just simply the dashboard for all of our members is the place basically where they come, they sign in every morning, they check their dashboard. Do they have any messages in their message box? The system has the ability to send and receive purchase orders, and also members are communicating with each other through the Food Hub system. And finally, in the dashboard section, we're actually suggesting connections that they might want to make based on the information that we have in their profile. So if you're a broccoli farmer, and you list that in your profile, the system is actually working much like Facebook. For those of you who are Facebook users, we're making suggested connections based on the information that we have about you. And the good news is, again, that it's actually working quite well. So that was my very brief presentation. I didn't come to tell you much more than there's a tremendous resource currently available to producers and buyers in the state of Oregon that I think could be leveraged with policies that support local buying.
Representative Wingard, and then
thank you, Mr. Chair. Deborah, great website. How much did it cost to put together?
Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, I would say Food Hub, to develop the basic Food Hub platform was about $100,000.
Okay.
And then, of course, there'll be ongoing maintenance costs.
How many users do you have?
610 users at this point.
That's probably increasing exponentially.
Daily, yes.
So is there a business model here for recouping the cost?
There is.
Perhaps it's even paying the grantees back and being totally sustainable in this great venture?
Isn't it, another fantastic question. I'm so glad you asked it. Food Hub is a unique project in that it is a project of the nonprofit EcoTrust, but it is a project with a business plan, which is relatively unique, I would say, in the nonprofit community. So the revenue model for Food Hub is membership fees. So maintaining an active profile within Food Hub costs $100 a year. We're at 600 members now. We'd like to be at about 4,000 by the end of next year for two reasons, because of the revenue that will generate for the system, but also because we think 4,000 is about the right size for the network so that members will really derive significant value for that $100 that they've invested. Beyond the membership fees, we can imagine a scenario where additional revenue streams could come into play, be it advertising within the site or preferential search returns, that
kind
of thing. And then finally, there's so much interest in Food Hub as a model that could be used in other regions that we can imagine a scenario where the platform would be licensed to other regions, and then EcoTrust, as the creator and owner of Food Hub, would recoup a lot of its development costs through sharing a percentage of those membership fees in other regions. Now, luckily, no one who's given us a grant has asked to be reimbursed. They weren't PRI grants. They were grants. Mm-hmm. But we do definitely foresee a day in which Food Hub will be self-sufficient.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Just so I understand, how much did the state contribute to the development?
Well, it's interesting. Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, I don't even know if you would call it state resources, and just because I don't understand the mechanics. So Food Hub received specialty crop block grant funding from USDA, mm-hmm. which is funneled through ODA, but whether that's state resources, I'm not sure I could say that it is. So provided that the specialty crop block grant money is not state money, then the answer is zero. And if it is state money, then the answer is $200,000.
Representative Emmerman.
Thank you, Chair. My presumption would be that the state probably earned a little money for administering the grant.
Some nods. The state's going to earn some money off the income taxes generated from these local sales, I can promise you that.
But I do have another question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Clem. How do they find out about Food Hub? How are people finding out?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Van Orman, folks are finding out about Food Hub through a variety of means, paid advertising. I mentioned being in Bend this morning. That was to speak at the Restaurant and Lodging Association's annual convention, trade show booths, et cetera, et cetera. We have a fantastic partnership right now in place and expect to have it in place long into the future with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Mm-hmm. We have actually trained colleagues throughout the state, whether it's the Blue Mountain RC&D in Hermiston, or again the Farm Bureau, or the Gorge Grown Food Network, to act as official ambassadors. Our belief as it relates to Food Hub is that this is a tool that could work in multiple communities across the state. It's not ours in many respects. It was developed with grant resources. It was developed in open source, with open source technologies. We want to make sure that the resource gets out there. So in many respects, we're relying on a network of networks effect, and hoping that people will really engage and embrace it as their own as they work to create greater ties between regional food producers and buyers in their own communities.
Okay. Representative Beckley, we're talking about Farm to School and all of our favorite programs here, just so you know. I just wanted to make sure you knew that. Yeah, good. Okay. All right. Thank you
so
much. Very exciting. If I had my checkbook, I'd give it to you now so I could get access. I've been trying to hack in. I just can't get in. It's very
frustrating. That's all about that self-sustainability model.
Yeah. No freeloading.
Yeah. I'm a computer guy. I just have to try. I wasn't cracking. I was hacking. It's different. Okay. let's, we don't need a break. Ready for Cougars, and we're going to finish early. Okay, so Kurt and Ron Anglin. Yeah, Peter, do you want to sit up here? Where, anywhere you want. No one's got to leave, too, so.
I warmed the seat up for you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, that's happened. It's happened once before, hasn't it?
She had it during the good fiscal period, though.
It was nice of her.
Oh, yeah. There's some written testimony as well. I'm just going to stay for the record and that you can have available. It wasn't really a public hearing, but we got some, so we'll share it.
All right. Tell us about Cougar target areas. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair Clem. For the record, my name's Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me today is Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. And before I let Ron describe some of the work we've done in our Cougar target areas, I'd like to just briefly give a very brief background and history of Cougar management in Oregon. So since the time of European settlement in the mid-19th century, cougars and all predators for that matter were actively managed and heavily hunted, trapped, and poisoned with the direct intent at the time was to minimize conflict with humans or livestock. Those activities went on through the mid-1960s, and up until the mid-1960s, cougars were considered a predatory animal. They were unprotected and, as I mentioned, hunted, trapped, and poisoned throughout the state. In the mid-1960s, at the request of the Oregon Game Commission, the legislature changed their status from unprotected predatory animal to a game mammal and turned over management of cougars to the then Oregon Game Commission, now Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission. At that time, in the mid-1960s, when their status was changed, we estimate that the population of cougars statewide was about 200. So, relatively small population when you consider the size of the state. The commission then began management, of course, with protection. Through the 1960s, 1970s, the population remained low, and hunting was reinitiated as the population began to grow. If you've been around the state, or if you talk to folks who spent their lives, their careers working in the woods or hunting through the 1960s, 1970s, I'm sure you'll hear from them that they never saw a cougar. And conflicts with, whether it be human safety conflicts or conflicts with livestock or the impacts on our big game herds were essentially non-existent. We did not have conflicts and or livestock depredations occurring at any level during the 1960s and 1970s. So with protection and then the slow reestablishment of hunting seasons through the 70s and 1980s, the hunting was tightly controlled. The most effective management of, or the most effective method of hunting cougars is to pursue them with dogs. That was the preferred method. I think if you go across the West, where cougar populations are healthy, that's still the preferred method in terms of maximizing an individual's opportunity to harvest a cougar. Along about in the mid-1990s, 1994, in fact, we had a voter-passed initiative in the state that prohibited the use of dogs when hunting cougars. At that time, we estimated the population statewide to be about 3,000 cougars statewide. Over through the 1990s, then without the most effective means of harvesting cougars, that is with the use of dogs, we took a more general approach in terms of we liberalized hunting seasons, we lowered the cost of cougar tags, and actually also increased the bag limit. A person can actually purchase now more than one cougar tag per year. Over that course of those ensuing 16 years, we've seen conflict rise, whether that be through documented depredation events on livestock or human safety complaints or concerns, as well as declining big game productivity in some of our key management units. We now estimate that the cougar population statewide is about 6,000 animals, so it's doubled from the mid-1990s level. In 2006, the Fish and Wildlife Commission adopted a cougar management plan, and a key piece of that plan is to address management objectives, whether that be reducing human safety conflict, reducing wild or livestock depredation, or improving big game herd status. They directed us in the plan to use administrative removals. So we, under current state law, the state agency has the authority to, through administrative means, to remove cougars to achieve management objectives, whatever they may be, and the commission has adopted those objectives. So 3 years ago, we began a process, of, I guess if you will, really a pilot program to look at administrative removals. One, to determine if we could even, as a government agency, effectively remove enough cats to make a difference. And two, as best we could, with very limited resources, try and evaluate the effectiveness or the efficacy of that program. So we embarked on that a little over 3 years ago now. We were in the course of developing a report to the commission on the effectiveness of this management action, and as part of our budget process in the 2009 legislative session, through a budget note, we were asked to have that report peer reviewed, which we have now done. And I would like to turn over this agenda item to Ron Anglin for a brief summary of the report, and then open it up for questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Klim, and members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. As Kurt mentioned, the Commission did give us the authority to, where appropriate, move forward with the pilot projects on addressing three different levels of conflict relative to cougars, and that had to do with human safety, livestock, and big game populations. And we surveyed our districts around the state and came up with three different areas to undertake within the original pilot project. For human safety, we looked at a portion of Jackson County. For livestock, we looked at our East Beulah game management unit, which is over out of Ontario and Vail. And for big game conflict, we looked at our Heppner management unit, which is a combination of private and public lands outside of Heppner in north central Oregon. And basically what each one of the qualifiers, we had to meet some certain objectives as stated within the plan that would allow us to move forward with any kind of a targeted administrative removal. We used a combination of Wildlife Services and our own employees to do the work, and established goals for removal of cats in each one of the areas for both individual year and also for over the course of the 3 years of the pilot. In the human safety area for Jackson County, did qualify for a targeted administrative removal. Our goal was to remove 24 cats per year over a three-year period. We ended up actually removing 24 cats total over that 3 years, and that was for a combination of reasons. And that was part of what this whole target area pilot program was established for, was to test the viability of doing these actions and be flexible in how we applied it. And what we found in the Jackson County one was that there was a large number of small scattered ownerships throughout the county. It made it very difficult to access and successfully access a lot of the property to do any kind of administrative work. The work that we were able to do was on the fringes, primarily on the east side of the target area, and where it was big blocks of private land. And that really limited our ability to go in and take any kind of cats out of this target area. And based on that, we weren't able to document that removal had any kind of a positive effect on the number of complaints that we received or the number of cats that were still being killed on human safety complaints. And we felt that looking at a target area under those kind of ownerships and land patterns probably would not be very effective at meeting the goals that were outlined for the Jackson County target area. Likewise, the Beulah unit was chosen for livestock damage. We had a history of cats being removed on damage complaints there where they had killed livestock. We met the targets needed to be able to implement the target area. Our goal was to remove 24 cats per year for 3 years. We actually removed about 12 per year over the or 12 total over the 3 years. What we did see was our overall number of complaints went down, the overall number of animals killed on livestock damage complaints went down, and we had a lot of satisfaction, I guess you'd say, within the landowner community that we that they felt that we had met the goals and objectives of the project. You know, we recognize it was a very small number of animals that were taken. We've had some comments that we've received as part of the peer review that criticized us, I guess you will, or offered comments on whether it was scientifically valid or not, and it would be very difficult to run any kind of a scientific validation or statistical validation on very small sample sizes like this and apply it over a broad area. We do feel just from a managerial standpoint that it did have a positive effect and a positive impact, but and we actually continued it one additional year because we had 1 year where we couldn't get out on the ground. We got a late start, and we're still looking at the results of that third year.
And excuse me, just you mentioned the landowner issue, but what about the number of elk and deer?
We did not, Chair Klim, specifically look at deer and elk populations in the Beulah unit in relation to what we were doing. It was strictly aimed at evaluating the impact on livestock.
Well, I will give you a report because I drew Beulah and I will be there hunting 1 week from now with my dad or whenever we start. So I will give you my own personal scientifically valid on mule deer at least.
Well, thank you, Chair Klim. Finally, the last target area that we had was for big game, and this was to address elk populations in the Heppner Management Unit. Heppner Unit had a rich history of a very strong elk population with high recruitment. In recent times, the recruitment levels had dropped substantially down to the point where we had around 17 calves per 100 cows in the springtime, which was far below maintenance levels, much less the ability to grow the population at all. Based on our research in Northeast Oregon, we didn't feel that habitat was the primary cause of this decline, that nutrition seemed to be very good over most of the range in Northeast Oregon. So we did specifically look at what would be the impacts of removing cats. Our goals were to remove I believe it was 60 cougars over the course of the project, which was 20 cougars per year. We actually removed 53 over the course of the last couple of years. We scaled back on some of the numbers, primarily because in addition to the cats we removed, hunters removed another 28 cats, and there was one cat killed on a livestock depredation complaint.
That's 82 total?
About 82 total, yeah.
That's just over, in the
just in the Heppner unit over the course of the 3 years. Now, obviously, or you know, we expect that there were probably some cats that moved in from adjacent areas where there wasn't this intense removal going on, and that we did see some of that movement across the landscape, and that in later years that was some of the cats that were being killed. But still, even we were surprised at the number of cats that did come out of the unit. We did see a dramatic increase in the calf recruitment from 17 calves per 100 cows up to 29 calves per 100 cows. We actually think that the Heppner unit calf survival was higher than that, but it was clouded a little bit because we had a couple of years of very heavy snowfall. And when that happens, what we found in previous radio telemetry studies in northeastern Oregon is that elk that typically winter in the Ukiah unit on Bridge Creek will drop down the North Fork of the John Day and move into the Heppner unit. So they'll move south, or they'll move west, actually, another 50, 60 to 70 miles, and they'll mingle with the elk that are wintering in the Heppner unit. And typically in the Ukiah unit, we've had calf ratios down in the 12 to 15 calves per 100 cows, and we feel that that was probably pulling down the overall Heppner unit calf ratio, and we didn't feel real comfortable on how to best tease that out and be able to portray those kind of results. There's been a lot of questions about what was the impact of deer, and have you seen a positive rebound in the deer population as a result of those removals? I can tell you that we don't know. And we don't know because we didn't design the study to look at deer, and the way that we count deer in the Heppner unit would not pick up those kind of subtle changes. Typically, when you see calves targeting in the deer population is going to be more adults, or just as much adults as they would a fawn. And our overall deer counts, we don't measure increases in adult survival, so we had no way of really picking that up and being able to estimate that. I can tell you from an anecdotal standpoint, I grouse hunt in this area. I've hunted there for over the last 7 or 8 years about 4 different times, and this is the first year that I've been there, and I've seen a lot of deer during the grouse season. So,
how many grouse did you get? Blue or rough?
A combination.
That's a nice disclosure.
Yeah, my hunting partner, and it's his area, would shoot me if I went much further here. But it was the first year for my dog, and she had a great time. So based on that, we felt that we did have a positive effect on calf survival, and we continue to monitor that population. We'll be doing modeling and trying to determine exactly what kind of a population increase that we expect that we got out of that. We'll also be doing long-term monitoring to determine how long do a benefit, if you will, did we get out of that level of removal. And certainly this was a learning experience for us as an agency, and I think that if it were applied on a regular basis in some of these units, you wouldn't be looking to take that level of calves out on a regular basis, but some kind of a maintenance level that ensured you had a very healthy calf population in conjunction with your population of other animals that were of interest to folks. So that's a real brief overview and summary. We did send the target area report out to a list of 14 different people soliciting comments. We received comments back from 6 of those. Most of them were from state agencies. One retired researcher out of Wyoming, and who's now a commissioner for Wyoming Fish and Game, and then a researcher out of Washington State. The comments were very beneficial. There were some very constructive criticisms in there, and I guess one of the things that did come up was some disappointment that, it wasn't necessarily set up in a scientifically rigorous manner that would be publishable, and we very deliberately did not run these as research projects that we plan to publish. These were couched from the very beginning as management projects, and you do those to a totally different level than what you would for a research project that you're looking to go ahead and go through the peer review process and publish. And that most state agencies, most of their actions are based on management projects and not on the research projects and the costs associated with doing significant research. So that's a real high-level summary of what happened over the last 3 years. And I will say also, I guess, real quick, that we were in the comments in addition to the some of the statistical and the ability to publish some of this or not be able to publish this, that there were comments recognizing the sensitivity of what we did and the applicability to all the Western states. We were being watched very closely by the other Western states and what we're doing because they're facing similar problems, and a real desire to look more closely at some of the habitat issues, and that may be driving the health of populations long term more than what most people realize. And then a couple of comments expressing a very sincere disappointment that hunters were not used to implement the target areas, and that the role of hunters versus government itself going in and removing cougars really is contrary to the North American model of wildlife management, where hunters are used as a management tool for wildlife populations.
And what are your thoughts on that? I mean, the agent thing would have allowed it, theoretically? The agent bill we did in 07 would have made it possible, or no?
No, Chair Clem, the agent bill would allow them to be volunteer agents for us,
yeah.
But it would not allow them to essentially retain any trophy, if you will.
Mm.
So we can use voluntary agents. They don't have to be paid employees.
Right.
But they'd still be hunting for the state, and they would not have the ability to retain the trophy or the animal. So, as you might imagine, it's a little more difficult to find volunteers. I think we did use some volunteers on some of these projects, but for the intensity of the work that's required, and I think some of the other states, if you look at what they pay in other states for administrative removals, they spend about $4,000 to $5,000 per animal in Arizona and in New Mexico. We spend about a little over $3,000 per animal. So actually, we're in the ballpark in terms of what it costs to remove these.
Okay. Representative Buckley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks.
Co-chair Buckley.
Thank you. Thank you for your indulgence, and thank you to your administrator for kindly making sure I was able to be here. You know, the budget note that the report responded to came from a desire to actually get to what the department has stated as it's one of its primary goals is to work in a manner that is based on scientific evidence. Back in the ODFW budget review in the subcommittee last year, that was the number one statement put out by the department, was that they based their work on scientific evidence. In a similar way that we ask for DEQ to, if they are going to regulate water or air, it has to be based on scientific evidence of what the impact is of the regulations. And this is it's a great concern to me that, again, I am not an expert in this field in any way, shape, or form. All I can do is take the concerns that constituents bring up or other people involved in the field bring up, and the one I can say is, well, we're doing this based on what? If we're doing it based on scientific evidence, we have something we can stand on. Obviously, I just want to make sure the committee was aware of the one scientific review of the report came back with the conclusion that the claims made in the report seem to be based on predetermined beliefs and philosophical positions, not scientific evidence. So it's a great concern of mine. The constituents that brought this to my attention to begin with were ranchers in the Applegate, who their concern was that in pursuing the plan as it is established, that we were counterproductive, that we could be actually increasing the numbers of human cougar conflict, we could be increasing the numbers of livestock destruction. And again, my hope was that the scientific review of the plan would say, no, that those concerns are not accurate, that we are not being counterproductive, that we are actually doing things on evidence-based practices actually scientifically verified, that evidence did not come through from the peer review of the report, and I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned that we're just going to continue doing something that obviously is based on a philosophy, and in other agencies we don't allow for that. We don't allow for it in DEQ. We don't allow for it in Human Services. We don't allow for it in other agencies. I'm concerned that we're allowing for it here. So I don't know if you'd want to respond to that, but again, I appreciate the time I could bring this to the committee's attention.
You're not obligated to, but
my friend and I can talk offline about my thoughts.
Sure. Chair Clem and Representative Buckley, I'll just be very brief. I think we're certainly sensitive to those issues that you raise. When we designed this Cougar Management Plan and the Commission adopted it, and when we went forward with the target areas, which are part of the basically adaptive management framework, we weren't setting up a rigorous scientific study. It's more like a clinical trial versus, you know, a rigorous scientific study. So that, I think that's the focus of much of the comments that you're referring to are really focused on the fact that this wasn't rigorous science. It was more of an adaptive management analysis. I think that... you know, if you went around the state or even the West to wildlife managers and you ask them, regardless of what the population is that you're trying to manage, whether the issue be sea lions or cormorants or pick the predator, and you ask the professional biologist, can you manage predators and have an impact in the environment, they're going to say yes. And I think that's kind of where we're coming from here. We think that we can manage predators, and have an impact, a beneficial impact on other species. So, but with that, Chair Clem, I'm good.
Well, and as I'm the only other member on the subcommittee in question, and so my interest, not only as the chair of this committee, but as a member of that subcommittee, I'm particularly interested in the deer and elk populations. And so I myself was interested in seeing what happens to deer and elk populations when the large number of cats that were 83 is a lot of animals. And so, you know, I don't know about the review on, you know, if the comments applied to that section too, that it wasn't scientific, but it's just plain nature. If there's that many predators in that close of an area and we're hunting them and they're hunting them, their numbers are going to go down. If we kill them, their numbers are the deer and elk are going to go up. There's nothing more rigorous than that to it. It's nature. So, you know, that part of it, Peter and I will go back and forth. We have different constituents. We have different districts. We have a lot of passion, both of us, and we will talk about it offline from there. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My friend from Southern Oregon or our guests here could comment on this, but for those of us who don't completely understand, and I'm sure it's not scientific either, but nonetheless, I'm interested in the counterintuitive argument from constituents that obviously are concerned. How is it that what could possibly actually be encouraging the growth of cats through the management procedures that we're following?
Yeah, it's an interesting deal.
And again, that's what the one reason we put the Washington State University in the budget, to require at least that review, is that Washington State University's research has shown that that cougar removal in this manner has the potential of removing older male cougars, which dominate a territory. And in the example we're talking about, the deer and elk population, it's possible, I don't know, but it's possible that by removing an older male cougar, that brings in young males into an ungoverned territory, more or less, and increases the number of kills, because young males are now in an area that was dominated by an old male. As the rancher in the Applegate who brought this to my attention said, it's like giving the drunken teenagers the keys to the car. You're giving the younger males the territory.
And we got some testimony to that effect from Washington State within a year. But remember, I also asked, what if you keep killing until you get to the biological sustainable level? And he said, well, yeah, then you get... Sorry, I will shut up.
Thank you. And it also makes an assumption that you're going to go after the trophy animals. And because of the system we set up, that's not what we do. We don't necessarily go after those, which is a different dynamic because we aren't hunting them. And I guess my question is, do you feel comfortable that we're able to use hunters to keep populations of deer and elk and others under control and reasonable levels? And if so, why would it be that we could do those animals, but we'd be unable to do it with other animals like predators. That's the part that it frustrates me at times. And part of the reason we don't is because we had a ballot measure, and that's the reason that we don't do some. And part of the reason we don't do some others is because the federal government has told us we shouldn't. So we have this department whose job it is to help us regulate all the wildlife in our state. And we have scientists who work for our department to help us do that. And we regulate everything except certain individual species, which we therefore can't regulate. And so how does that make the whole plan work, in your opinion? Because that's the part that frustrates me. If we trust them to regulate one certain species and we don't the other, it skews it. It doesn't make it work. So how does that work for you?
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, you certainly raise one of the classic issues that we face, in that we don't always have complete control over whatever the species may be, whether it be geese, or whether it's federally managed, or pinnipeds, marine mammals, which are federally protected, or cormorants, which are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. We always face these federal constraints. And it's a source of frustration, of course, for the professional wildlife managers, I would say, generally not just in Oregon, but probably across the country. With regard to your question about how can we effectively how can we use hunting to effectively control deer and elk numbers, but not cougars, I think it really comes down to what would, you know, scientists would refer to it as a huntability or catchability coefficient. Each of these species there's a different ability for humans to encounter them, and cougars are extremely secretive, extremely intelligent, very stealthy. All those things add up to make it very difficult to have a targeted cougar season, if you will, absent the use of dogs, which are of great assistance in that endeavor.
We've heard both from you and I think the federal government a lot of times, this whole idea of adaptive management, that we watch what we're doing and we adjust based on that adaptation. Is there a possibility ever that in the federal government, as well as our own state, we could get a waiver with respect to the federal government so that we as a state take a responsibility for managing all of the species within our borders to keep them at levels that are healthy for the individual? I mean, we're going to have in my opinion, a major pedipede die out in the near future, because disease is going to happen, because every large population that gets overpopulated has a limit, and then all of a sudden the close proximity creates massive deaths, and everybody's going to be wondering, why are these dead sea lions on the beach? What aren't you doing to stop them? And so on and so forth. So my concern, is there a way to get a waiver from all of these different things for our state to manage the resources which we are supposed to be managing? I mean, that's one of the state resources.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, I don't know if there's an easy answer to that question. I'm with regard to some of those species that cross international boundaries, we have treaties that are signed with other countries, which I think a state's ability to just entirely opt out would be highly unlikely. For others, for marine mammals, pinnipeds, we have approached that. In fact, 2 years ago, I believe it was in Congress, there was a bill that would have given much more authority back to the states for California sea lion management. That never made it out of committee. I think they told us, go ahead and try. You have the ability right now to do some management on sea lions. Use the act that you have now, and if that doesn't work, come back to us. So that's what we're doing. We actually have a control program in place at Bonneville where we're, you know, we do lethally remove sea lions. We have sea lion issues at Willamette Falls, which the speaker has been very interested in and seen us move forward there as well. So we're working those as best we can within the federal frameworks.
It's amazing how quickly.
Just the final one. So we have developed freshwater sea lion now by our past management practices that didn't exist before.
A river lion.
A river lion. Anyway, yeah. To come.
Let's let that one go. Vice Chair Krieger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I can remember the last year we had the Washington study come before us, and I was absolutely amazed that was science, because that wasn't peer-reviewed. and a bunch of the hockey puck that was in that study was beyond belief. I mean, I spent 28 years with the State Police Game Division out there managing, helping your department manage resources, and many things were stated in the Washington Report that absolutely are mucky business. And everybody in the room knew it, but the guy had the guts to sit there and say it anyway. It was somebody's agenda. It had nothing to do with science. Now, there is a Dr. Paul Asma, Oregon State University, put out a paper called Science 101. I gave that to you, some of you, especially the Coastal Caucus. And it talked about the difficulty of people who are scientists, professors, when they do peer reviews and stuff, to keep their personal bias out of that. Everybody in this room should read that, because it'll make you understand you cannot just turn to science to get all of your answers, because it has a bias in it, even when they try to take it out of it. So remember that. Dr. Paul Adams, Oregon State, Science 101. You know, I can remember getting to Curry County in 1964, which is just over the hill from you, really. You know, we had cougars a little bit up towards Carpenterville and up towards Langlois. In 28 years, I saw two out in the field, thousands and 30,000 miles a year, 5.5 years of overtime. I was out there. After they protected them, that changed. Not only were they taking them at Carpenterville, seeing them, and the government trappers having to take 3 and 4 times as many, and same at Langlois and up in that part of the country, but basically, the coastal blacktail disappeared totally in some areas. We used to kill 5 bucks in our ranch. I haven't killed one there for 5 years, and I haven't seen a deer on the ranch in the last 6 months. They're gone. There isn't anything that knocks them down to that degree, including the hair disease. But there was definitely a increase in the population when the dogs went away. It only makes common sense that if you reduce that population, that those other animals, you know, the deer, the elk, whatever it might be, are going to come back, just as the chair had mentioned. If you use that philosophy that when you take some away, and I mentioned this morning to a member, then you're just like telling me, I'll take my bull away from the cows and I'll have the same number of calves next year. No, it ain't going to happen. Just common biology tells you that if you have a higher population of predators and you drop that population down, the other's going to come back up. It's a balance. That's what nature does, irregardless of whether or not. Mr. Chair, we're working with a cormorant work group, and you know how we got the bill through, got the position in. 50% of our Oregon smolts are taken by cormorants. That's what we're looking at. 26 states are managing them. We're going to go forward management. But this is an emotional issue, and therefore science is swayed by that emotion, and people are not separating the two. It's difficult. I don't know anybody anywhere that wants to kill the last cougar, the last cormorant. But you, all of us, do you allow just as many mice in your house as want to live there, or rats in your barn? How about moles on your yard? What do? You get rid of them because of the negative impact. It's just common sense. And to have people come in, not referring to you, Mr. Chair, but others, and act as if there's not going to be an impact from increases numbers of cormorants and that it's natural and it'll take it, What do you think's happened as our salmon populations come up? Why do you think we didn't recover wild endangered salmon like we thought we would have when we put literally, not millions, but billions into restoration on all of our coastal streams in the Columbia? Only come to find out the Caspian terns and cormorant populations came up and took all that recovery fish and ate them. That's what happened.
Without even a thank you.
If you see them, yeah.
See you guys.
All right. All right. Thank you. Now, so, and you too, at least, for the committee's benefit, I have asked the department get me essentially the language that the state of Washington used. It's a democratically controlled legislature, and not long after their initiative, they changed their initiative statutorily to allow some cougar hunting in certain counties, rural eastern Washington counties, and signed it into law. You know, Governor Gregoire did four or five years after the ballot measure passed. So I've asked that to be drafted. There's some members doing the same thing, apparently, individually. So for those of you interested in that effort, not everybody, as I understand, but that there will be either a committee bill or a member bill dealing with this topic moving forward. And if you want on the, if you want a committee bill, we'll do a committee bill. If you want individual bills, we can do it that way too.
Let me know.
I had a conversation with Representative Springer yesterday, and she had something going. But I told her there's probably five people all doing the same thing, so we should get together and coordinate. And that's, and she agreed.
Mr. Chair, I would never contradict on purpose the vice chair, but you got to admit that if you were a black-tailed deer in your area, your ranch is the last place you'd want to go. We'll take this up later.
We'll lose. Thank you for a good committee hearing today. I was going to try and finish on the food hub. It was a little less, you know, emotional. But, sorry about that.
This is
Georgia.
Yeah.